I was born in 1933 on a Monday. My dad was a seaman and go abroad. He was a ship's carpenter. He was in his 30s. And on a Friday, I was October the 2nd, it was on a Monday. On the Friday, he was given the sack with hundreds of others. There's no ships, no trade. In America, it's a depression. Here is a recession, but it's still a depression. Nearly 4 million unemployed. Anyway, 1938 comes along, and things all of a sudden start to get better. But it's ruined by a flaming war, isn't it? 1939. Now, that started, I was going to be 6 in the October 1939, and the war started. Now, we had this wonderful war, and 1945 it's finished with. We had the VE Day, and then in Japan dropped the bombs. But now they can have this general election, and outside of the factory, which is gone now, Wakin Dean's factory, Mr. Orewin is the Conservative MP for the Western Supermare constituency. And as far as I know, he's doing his speech, he's saying his bit. And there was lots of men there, and a lot of them wore their old battle dress. The badges was gone, but they were. And I can see him now. One bloke saying, "You're not going to do to us what you lot have done prior to this effing war." Well, first of all, laugh as you may, I went home to my dad and I told my dad what this man had said. I didn't understand effing, all right? So he's not a nice word, he said. He said, "Well, son," and then he told me now about how difficult it was that he never went to work from 1933 to 1938. 5 years unemployed. They had to give the keys up because he was buying a house at South Liberty. Couldn't afford that. My mum got fined £5 because she couldn't pay the rates to Bristol Corporation. And I haven't got it. My brother has got the card where my dad had to go and do work to get certain foods, and one of them on there was margarine, not butter. We don't do that today. And that got me thinking, and I read as many books as I possibly could about politics, and then I used to ask questions.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 12th of January 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Yes, our very own app. Do hope you've got it. I suppose I should say there's no spyware on it, but I've no idea. You know, we're not supposed to know these things, are we? But anyway, it works. And all the little clips, the longer clips from the various interviews that we do, it loads those automatically, sort of 11 o'clock midnight tonight. And you can have a listen to them anytime you want. If there's an interview that you think, it's the same, that was a little bit short, you can listen to the whole thing using the app. And also, of course, via the main website, which is thisweek.org.uk. You can get that from the Aurora App Store, which is a replacement for the Google Play Store with all the right stuff in it, not the wrong stuff, because Google censor it. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, psyops, well, just lies, really. Puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes. The witch hunt's going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III and wage slavery lies. So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Fourth Reich Matrix, whatever you want to call it, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also Cotton councillor here in Bristol for the Greens, Guy Pulteney. So we'll start with you, Guy. I mean, we've got lots to talk about tonight, including not least of which is the declaration, Britain's declaration of war on Yemen, even though they haven't officially declared war on them, and neither have the Americans. They just start. I suppose this is part of the war on terror. We're just going to, oh, these people are terrorists, we're going to kill them. But we'll be talking a lot about that later. But we're going to start with some domestic Bristol politics. Guy, tell us a little bit about yourself, because you started as a Lib Dem, didn't you? What made you jump ship and move over to the Green Party, which, by the way, it looks as if may well take control of Bristol after May?
Well, we cross our fingers. I was originally elected as a Lib Dem back in 2009, and did 4 years on the council. And of course, a year after I got elected, the Lib Dems joined the coalition with the Conservatives to form the first ghastly 5 years of, you know, Conservatives in government. And as that became more and more miserable, and as it became clear that there was no going back from that, that the party had kind of gone in a new direction, I found myself working with independents like George Ferguson and some of the independent councillors and candidates more and more. And then through the cross-party cabinet, started meeting the Greens, people like Gus Hoyt, Daniela Ricci, and found myself in really good company. And yeah, the more I got involved with the Greens, the more I liked it. And then stood myself in 2016, near miss, and then won in 2021.
So what about, many of our listeners will think, well, there's no point in getting involved in politics, particularly at a national level, but even at a local level. And here in Bristol, you've been kind of kiboshed, haven't you, by the system now, where the mayor decides everything. You councillors are sort of, you're part of the furniture.
Well, there's almost total executive authority rests with the mayor. It's really, really challenging. I speak to councillors every day. There's a huge frustration. I'd say this is true from across all parties, actually. You just can't get things done for your local residents that desperately need doing.
Can you give us an example? The local residents will contact their MPs on some issues, local councillors on others. I mean, it might be something as simple as, hey, there's only three streetlights in our street, and none of them are actually working anymore. Can we please get some light bulbs in them?
Yeah, there are things that are just sort of fixable through the standard kind of processes that where if you're lucky, you get a good council officer and you report it and it just gets done. But I've got ongoing problems in the ward. The one that jumps out at me is bins on streets, because it's so easily fixable. You just go around and tell people not to do it. You do enforcement. But it only takes 4 or 5 bins down a pavement. If you've got cars parked just off the pavement, suddenly both sides of the street are impassable to pedestrians. If you're in a wheelchair or you've got a buggy, you've got an absolute nightmare. And this is an easy problem to fix, but no one seems to be able to. And there's no way of referring it up the system. Equally, you get something massive like Kingsdown Sports Centre. A couple of years ago, absolutely no one wanted to lose that sports centre. And yet, Mayor and Cabinet can simply pass it through against the result of a consultation, and suddenly it's no longer a council sports centre anymore.
I get the idea that actually the Bristol City Council is turning more into a business. It's looking at each area of its activity more as a profit centre. Now, in the old days, I have actually got a copy of the city accounts from the 1940s, late 1940s, and you can see that all of the money seems to be being spent in various ways. Public transport was all run by the council. They would deliver a modest profit, a very small profit, but the idea was that all the things that don't work very well commercially, and public services, even at those times, they were running cheap food outlets for people who had hardly any money that needed to have something to eat, things like that. But now it seems everything's just a profit centre, so it may as well be run like a business.
Well, whilst ideologically that's appalling to me as an idea, even people who would say or believe it should be run like a business, I think would expect it to be run competently like a business. They'd expect it to be run well like a business, and it's not even that.
Martin, things have been changing a lot, haven't they, over the last 20 years or so, and particularly since the LibCon coalition that Guy was talking about there. Actually, funding for local authorities has been going right down. It's almost as if it doesn't matter who you elect, none of them are going to be able to do much because the money pot is shrinking all the time.
Well, if Osborne landed the bulk of the austerity budgets on the local authorities, and that's quite a clear political calculation involved in that, because local authorities, particularly in big inner city areas, were unlikely to be conservative. So they're the ones who have to carry out the cuts. And therefore, in other words, they're giving a message to people: if you want extra money, vote conservative. if you vote as a protest vote for the Labour Party, then you're not going to get any money. And of course, this is a calculation. But of course, underlying all of that was the idiocy of the economics of it, because in actual fact, as the austerity bit, and I tend to have this out with Nick Clegg when he's just elected, as austerity bit, the economy started to go down and the deficit increased and they lost the country's AAA credit rating. I put this to Nick Clegg when he'd just been elected as Deputy Prime Minister because he came to Bristol. Tony joked it was the longest question ever. But the question was long because I was trying to suss out whether he understood the economics of what he was doing. And of course, he was way over his head. He didn't know what I was talking about. Osborne probably would have known what I was talking about, but he didn't, you know, as far as they're concerned, they're trying to shrink the state as an ideological goal. They're still talking like that. Whereas in actual fact, the Japanese have been trying to cut public expenditure since the 1980s and they've never succeeded, because you can't. Once you're in a crisis, you can't cut public expenditure. Attempts to do it just tip the economy down the drain, as a Labour government will discover.
Well, I'm very bad at this on this programme. I've got my own obsessions and I sometimes miss the big stories of the week. You know, I just think, oh, well, it's been covered, so let's not bother here. But we can't not talk about the post office scandal. It's a combination. There's an excellent ITV documentary, an hour or so long, which detailed it. Guy, do you just want to say what you make of this? Because it's easy to just poke fun at opposite political parties, but it's surely a symptom of a far wider malaise. At least three suicides, hundreds of families destroyed, savings mangled, and all because there was a malicious prosecution going on here.
A malicious prosecution is part of an organisation that, I mean, you see this happen in different ways in different parts of public sector and the private sector, where you get an organisation that is doing terrible things to individual people, but is doing it in such a way that no one individual within that organisation ever feels accountable. And that seems to be really at the core here. Everyone thought, I'm just one part of a system that's doing this, but there was no one person to point at and go, it was them.
It's something kind of groupthink about it, Martin, isn't there? This is, everyone is thinking, everyone is kind of pulling together here. It's very cliquey.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to what I was saying earlier, of course, the post office was put into the private sector by
Vince Cable.
Yeah.
And, of course,
that was a clear indication
of where the Liberals had changed their spots,
I don't know.
Frankly. You know, I mean, that would have been unthinkable in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And, of course, that you then move, correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, was the post office in the public or the private sector when this Horizon stuff was going through? Well, I don't know either, but I think in actual fact this is all part of because they bring in an outside firm, for example, to provide the computer stuff. Yeah, it's all about outsourcing. Yeah, Fujitsu or whatever it's called. Back in the old days, the British Post Office and British Telecom would have done it in-house, all of that stuff. Now, they wouldn't necessarily have got it right, but you wouldn't have a situation where nobody's responsible because it's been handed down a subcontracting chain to somebody and we don't understand it, that's what's going on. And that is a fundamental problem with outsourcing. And when we had a Labour government, when I worked in the council briefly, they bought into this outsourcing stuff as well, not to the same extent as the Tories, but the whole idea that, you know, the old-fashioned system is bureaucratic, you know, we've just got one National Health Service. Gosh, just one? Yes, it's like, well, yes, just one. That's the whole point about it. Things like that can be efficient because, you've got economies of scale. You know what, you know, you haven't, I mean, the kind of internal market in the health service and having trust, NHS trust, it leads to a situation, if you're going to have a competition, some people have to lose and go bankrupt. And that's what competition means. And if you don't go bankrupt, then there ain't a competition.
But to get back to Bristol City Council for a minute, since Guy's here, we had a pretty good look last week at this business of Annie Stafford Townsend, who's the chair, I think, of one of the main planning committees in the city and also a Green councillor. She was told live in a full council meeting that she was the subject of a complaint. And that complaint was discussed at the full council meeting. Now, these are supposed to be confidential. In the same meeting, you've also got questions to the mayor about the whole complaints process. So it's almost as if they're, without realising it, demonstrating their utter incompetence by talking about a confidential complaint in the full council at the same time as people are asking questions. Is your complaints process up to scratch?
I mean, the whole disciplinary, the sort of code of conduct for councillors has just been refreshed as we move into the committee system. That's coming in May. It was a good opportunity to review that. It's been strengthened a little bit.
Now, is it okay? Is it that the rules laid down are no good, or is it the people who are actually supposed to be overseeing them enforcing them?
Oh, I mean, I can't remember the last time a successful complaint was made against a sitting councillor. Should I know if that had happened? Is a judgment to be made.
But this is like quality control, this system, isn't it? It should be fairly, you know, if a councillor does something really silly, really stupid, really wrong, then they should be caught by the complaints process. And equally, it shouldn't be used as a political tool to just sort of bully councillors.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, should that have been raised at full council in that way? Absolutely not. That's disgraceful. That should not have been raised in that way. Lord Mayor should have shut it down immediately. The Mayor certainly shouldn't have exacerbated the situation and escalated it in the way that he did as well. I feel terrible for Annie, who I think conducted themselves absolutely, you know, with a huge amount of integrity throughout this whole thing.
Okay, so tell us a bit about this process. What's going to happen in May? What's the council going to look like once the mayor goes? Because Marvin has this marvellous ability, it seems, to not only get rid of himself, get rid of the whole position of mayor at the same time.
Well, yeah, so we started organising a referendum as soon as we sort of were in time to do that. The original legislation that enabled Bristol to bring in a mayor by a referendum allowed, and a huge thank you to... now Baroness Barbara Jank, who absolutely insisted that there be an exit mechanism because Bristol was the only city that voted to have an elected mayor. 10 years on, you can have another referendum to review whether you wanted that or not. And I started working cross party as soon as we could around that, and got the referendum pretty quickly. And then we managed to get the right result on the day. So the mayor will leave office at the end of this municipal cycle, and we will have a committee system starting from May of this year.
Okay, so what's that going to look like? Is it going to be the same as before the mayor? Just explain, how, because we elect, isn't it, 70 councillors or something in the city. You've got to somehow scatter them around various committees, and also you've got to decide who's going to be leader.
Yeah, so leader will be decided by a vote of full council. What are currently scrutiny commissions will be replaced by policy-making committees and committees that will look at, you know, is council policy up to scratch? Is it being delivered well? So that those responsibilities will sit either with... So the responsibilities of the mayor will either go to those committees or they will remain with full council.
Okay, so how's that different to this, I think it's called the One City process, where there's quite a lot of policy bodies, but they are not, in fact, I don't know if councillors are even on them.
So, I mean, it's controversial, that whole area. So the One City, and I should say I'm not an expert on One City, this is something that happened before I came back in. One City approach, as I understand it, was something that the mayor set up to bring in the kind of, I think what he would say are sort of key stakeholders, but sort of big players, big institutions within the city, bring all of them together so that there's an extent to which what the council's doing is joined up with what, say, the water company's doing, the university's doing, major employers are doing in the city, that kind of thing. There's been an accusation for quite a long time that favours, to be honest, companies, organisations, rather than people of Bristol. Right? At the end of the day, you have those organisations have a seat at a table and no one is there to represent the people of the city other than the mayor. Councillors are, I believe, now allowed to come to those meetings. And that, you know, One City will continue into the committee system. Those decisions have yet to be taken on what its future is.
I mean, you're being quite polite about this, not really, because it sounds to me like a kind of invite-only policy. You know, these are invite-only policy forum where decisions can be made about which direction the city's going.
I should say, One City doesn't formally make decisions. The idea that they're not steering council policy would be mad. Like, that clearly is part of that whole process. I am just glad at the end of the day, if local councillors are making decisions, whether it be in policy committees or local area committees, which is genuinely a really exciting thing. I'm really, really happy we're going to have a lot more devolution of power to more local areas. But at the end of the day, those people are more accountable. Your local councillors are far more accountable to local people than the mayor can be. And that's why I think the new system will genuinely tilt the balance back in favour of local people and communities rather than the big players, as it were.
Now, let's just get this absolutely straight, because here in Bristol, I think I'm right in this saying now that Greens are the largest group on the City Council.
Yeah.
That means you're likely, if Labour doesn't do too well, and they are not looking great at the moment, that the Greens are likely to be the party governing the city. What do you make of this? Because this might be one of the, maybe other than Brighton, which has had Caroline Lucas as an MP, one of the first green cities in the country, green run cities. But then we've also, of course, got we've got other parts of the country that might, is it even possible, because we've got MPs general election too at some point this year, possible to have a Green MP? What do the Green Party think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, the new seat of Bristol Central is a lot. It's mostly made up of the former Bristol West seat, which was our closest outside Brighton Pavilion, has been for, gosh, almost a decade now, and some of Labour's strongest seats are no longer in that, but we've been campaigning like crazy. We've got an overwhelming majority of the councillors in that parliamentary constituency. We just need to make sure that people know that's the choice that they've got in Bristol Central. It's going to be Labour or it's going to be Green. There's no way to vote to kick the Tories out, because they're long kicked out of that particular part of the city. So if people want Green, they can vote Green safely in Bristol Central.
Is that the only constituency, do you think? Are there any possibilities of other? Because, I mean, a lot of these are quite... I remember we were discussing this last couple of weeks with Valerie Davey in the noughties and the Iraq War. She was a sitting Labour council, quite comfortable majority. Well,
MP.
A sitting Labour MP, and there was a sudden swing against her. Well, she abstained in the Iraq War vote, and that was seen by the voters as, look, you know, this woman, what's this woman playing at? And suddenly the Lib Dems were in there. So how about any of the other MPs?
Oh, in Bristol, it's gonna be really tough to see in the sense that there's huge appetite in the country to just get the Tories out. I don't see very much chance of the Conservatives taking any of the Bristol seats at all. It then becomes a case of who's best placed to win in those seats. But as I say, our main focus is going to be on Bristol Central. That's not to say we don't have fantastic candidates in those other seats.
Okay, look, now let's look about other parts of the country. The Greens, obviously Brighton, Bristol here, potentially another MP. Where else?
Waveney Valley is one I would definitely
be
watching.
Where on earth is that?
So that's in... I forget the name of the seat's previous identity.
So there's been a lot of juggling with constituencies. Waveney Valley. Martin, your thoughts about this possibility of several Green MPs possibly at the next?
Well, I think Guy's put his finger on it. There's such a desire to get the Tories out that most people are going to be voting for the best place candidate to do that. But in Bristol Central, they will have the lucky opportunity to vote for a Labour MP or for a Green MP. And under those circumstances, given the history of the seat, it's likely, to my mind, that the Labour Party are going to have an uphill struggle to retain it. Not necessarily the case in other seats. Because, the thing about Thangam is that she's got quite a big majority, and therefore there's no danger, as Guy said, that any third party is going to take that seat. And the Liberal Democrats have disappeared largely from the inner cities and the cities in general. I think they've still got some good chances in what were Tory heartland seats. They've got a chance to take those, I think, which is all to the good.
Guy and I were both looking up Waveney Valley, East Suffolk, so that's on the East Anglia coast somewhere. Also with the Greens, I mean, there is a sort of tussle going on within the environmental movement at the moment, and has been for several years, about what it means to be green, because we've got this very vehement anti-car agenda. There's also I think it's in it called the 15-minute cities and various other things, like, for example, our clean air zone, which a lot of people would argue has got nothing to do with clean air. It's just a way of getting some money in for the city. So whereabouts do you stand personally on these sort of, I suppose you could call them green controversies? Because certainly in the past, in my political past, we were always fighting for decent free public transport as a way to just people don't need a car. They can use the public transport to get to work. And in my lifetime, I've seen the rise of the car, you know, becoming an obsession, really, because of the destruction of public transport. And we're seeing in Bristol at the moment less and less buses available. There were loads of cuts last year in the bus services. So if you're going to persuade people to leave their cars at home, you've surely got to have a cheap, reliable alternative.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, public transport's the absolutely the consistent thing that the city's raised for years and years and years and years. There's been a total decline in the offer of that bus service. My own community, we've in effect lost our entire bus service. There's one remaining. We get the 72 service once an hour, if you're lucky, running through the middle. And then on the edges of the area, you've got the showcase bus routes going up White Ladies Road and up Gloucester Road and Cheltenham Road. But it's a very hilly area. If you're elderly, again, if you're pushing a buggy, if you've got mobility issues, that's no good.
I get quite frustrated listening to the mayor and others saying, well, people should go on their bike. Well, I'm thinking about these sort of 85-year-old ladies and people like this in the pouring rain and the wind. What they're saying really is that if you want a car, you're going to have to pay at least £10 to go and pick your shopping up once a week, or every day you use it. And this seems to me to be, I mean, I can remember working years ago in London in journalism and looking at the East London River crossing and chatting to the Department for Transport. This is late 1980s, and they said, what we really want, this is Jim Bode was his name, I think he was the Deputy Permanent Secretary at the Department of Transport, saying what we really want is road pricing. And this is slowly what they're getting, isn't it? By bit, the idea that everywhere you drive, you pay, not just for the fuel, not just for the fuel tax, not your car tax, but also for going through the thin air. You know, you're actually paying to drive through those places. And the beginnings of that seem to be happening in the in these clean air zones like we've got here in Bristol and the ULEZ in London.
I mean, you've got, at the end of the day, the climate crisis is a catastrophic threat. Like, there is no greater sort of threat to the survival of humanity than that. The problem is implementing that at a local level. If you jump on one solution to anything, like, you know, say 15-minute cities for everyone all the time, anyway, you'll make life worse for a significant number of people. Everyone needs to have an eye on the granular detail. Do you know what I mean? This is one of those situations where, just in my ward and the neighbouring ward, pedestrianisation of Cotton Hill seems largely to have been really successful. The traders are generally quite pleased to have the streets back. There was an attempt to do the same thing on Chandos Road, completely different situation. We're absolutely opposed to the total pedestrianisation of Chandos Road. It won't work for those businesses, for those residents, for those traders. You've got to make it work for people with mobility issues, as you say. You've got to make it work for local small independent businesses, because they need those. Very often, you know, practical concerns matter.
So you've given up on the idea of having decent public transport then?
Oh,
so
absolutely
the idea
not.
It sounds like you have, though, because the idea is either you give some people an alternative way to get around, or you start shutting roads off as a way to sort of just stop people getting from A to B in their cars.
Oh, so that was my fault completely. No, absolutely in favour of better public transport. One of the things I'm most pleased about in my neck of the woods is that we now have the Severn Beach Line train coming through every half an hour, and now we've got a link to Western Super Metro. Like, that's arguably our biggest strength in terms of our transport infrastructure. But we need more buses, we need better buses. You're right, we need to. If people are going to get out of their cars, it's because there's a good alternative.
But the council doesn't have any control over the buses anymore. I think it's the Metro Mayor, isn't it, who's involved in all his own scandals. I don't know how he manages to get into so many. So we've got this kind of two-tier mayoral system. How do you think that's been working? Because this is relatively new over the last decade or so. We've got a city mayor, and we've also got something called a Metro Mayor. And it looked to me, I remember when that first happened, it looked to me as if they said, well, the city mayor is never going to be a Tory, so if we widen the area out a bit more, then maybe we'll get a Tory one. But anyway, how's that working? Because it's almost like these two competing mayors, even though they're both Labour, they seem to be at each other's throats the whole time.
I don't even know if they're talking to each other at the moment. It's been... I mean, don't get me wrong, my experience of talking to Dan Norris, working with Dan Norris, has been generally quite positive. He seems to be listening, he seems to be interested, he seems to be on top of his brief. But that said, there's a whole array of things I don't know about what he's doing. But you're right, having that overlap is it seems like a massive waste of resources. If transport sits with the Metro Mayor, it should sit with the Metro Mayor. We shouldn't have a competing vision coming out of Bristol City Council that huge sums of money are being poured into with seemingly no prospect of a result. I don't know how you feel about the underground. But that's where we are.
So is it going to happen?
I don't see an underground. I don't see an underground of the type that I think people associate with the word underground in Bristol. I just don't think it's practical. The idea of digging up large chunks of Gloucester Road for that amount of time without losing one of the most important economic generators of the city, it just doesn't seem plausible. I'm not against tunnels. We've got tunnels on the existing railway structure. But surely go for do the most good with the resources that we've got. That strikes me as being the most sensible thing. And at the moment, you've got communities that don't have any bus provision at all.
It strikes me, Martin, that actually public transport in Bristol was better during the 1930s.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could say that we could...
Obviously, the population's
gone
up. If
we were going to do things again, we'd do them differently. I mean, you've got that public information film from the 1940s, Getting Bristol to Work. And they had a whole, basically the buses were organised like a military campaign to get everybody up to Filton and back again every day. And, of course, people didn't have cars, yeah? You weren't trying to get them out of cars. There weren't very many around. And I can remember as a kid in the 1960s at Merseyside, we could play in the streets because there weren't any cars, We shouldn't have got rid of the railways and so on.
These are suburban streets you're talking about, residential streets.
Yes, exactly.
So there'd be about three or four cars down there, and they would go and come and go maybe once a day, each car. So it was safe.
Yes, I know.
But
of course, you can't. Lots of mistakes were made, which we could go through. But we are where we are now, and one of the problems is that local authorities don't have the powers that they had in those days to do the things that they need to do. You know, it's basically all been farmed out, and also, you know, there's no overall, you know, because of the war and everything, there was a whole idea that, you know, this stuff has to be properly organised. You know, we've got to get the workers to the factories, otherwise we're not going to produce the bombs to defeat the Germans and all the rest of it. We've lost all of that. And it's become, the market will decide, But the whole privatisation of buses was an absurdity.
But surely this is a great thing for the Greens. Deindustrialisation, less pollution. I mean, this is a green heaven, having no industry.
Oh, I mean, I don't think that's quite true. But you get things like, for example, the Green New Deal proposals that Labour has its version, we have our version of it, but I think at the core, the idea that you spend a lot of money to, for example, insulate people's houses, which saves on energy bills, it eliminates fuel poverty, it creates jobs at the same time, that's a good way of spending public money in such a way that, and you also need to train a lot of people up to deliver things like that. That's also, it's phenomenal for the skill sets of the city. It makes people more employable. It's hard to see the downside of a project like that, yet getting that joined up for delivery is challenging. And just to Martin's point quickly, I think the nightmare that you get with getting public transport infrastructure investment in anything, be it rail, be it buses, is now you in effect have to guarantee the profits of the private companies that you're trying to attract in.
There shouldn't be private companies at all. They should never have been allowed into the sector in the first place. But when we had a new Labour government for 13 years, they took the view is, we've got to... I mean, they were under pressure from the rail unions and a lot of Labour activists. Why don't we renationalise the railways? Mm. And the line always taken by the leadership was, look, we've got other priorities than that. You know, we can't spend money on that when we've got other things to do. Of course, that was disingenuous because of the franchise system. As each franchise runs out, you can just take it over. You don't have to pay any money. And in actual fact, what's actually happened is various companies, private companies, have dumped their franchises back on the government when they couldn't make any money. So in other words, the whole thing was misconceived from the get-go.
Okay, so what I want from you, Guy, is this is the green vision. This is what we're going to do. Okay, we might only have a handful of MPs, but here in Bristol City Council, with its budget a billion, is it? I'm not sure exactly how much.
And in terms of total, like, cash going through the council, yeah, I believe it's a little over a billion.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of money to play with. If and when the Greens take over in May, what's your vision to do? Because that's our cash. What are you going to do with it?
So let me be really clear. First of all, I do not speak for the party on this. There is a manifesto group, because obviously we take a lot of direction from our members, and we're also having huge numbers of conversations with different groups in the city at the moment around this. But with that disclaimer aside, what would I like to see? I would like to see a decentralisation. I would like to see far more of those decisions being made by local councillors in their local areas, in front of local people, where there's real accountability, and when people actually have an expertise in their local area. That would be the thing that, to me, I think would make the biggest difference. And I think there's also a huge culture change to happen around, again, speaking for me, stepping away from this idea of the big grand strategy for the city, the big vision, and actually just being a bit more responsive and listening a little bit more to the city and making sure that we're actually addressing the needs of the people that live here, rather than coming up with what we think the city should be and trying to impose that, because that has not worked.
No, it sounds good what you're saying, because I know over the years had sat on committees with various different chairs, and I would say they're on a sort of spectrum, really, from listeners to leaders, people who seem to think that it's their job to tell everyone else what to do, and they've already decided basically before the meeting what they want to do. But you're one of the latest, just looking at the local paper this week, Bristol allotment fees to double as plot holders launch campaign. Now, this is one of those things that is just the life and breath of the city. In fact, most cities, it's the same sort of thing. Allotments are really important places to socialise, to be a little bit of an enable the family to beef up the food supply a little bit. I mean, it was seen, obviously, during the war, as really, really important. But just generally, going with, as hundreds of years ago, people came to be urbanised and put into cities for industrial reasons and labour reasons, there was always a recognition that it's nice to have a little plot of land to grow a bit of food on, or even if it's flowers, maybe. But anyway, a consultation's been launched into proposed new charges for sheds, ponds, greenhouses, and keeping bees and rabbits and chickens. So if you're going to actually make your allotment productive, it looks to me, and there's a campaign been started by a lady called Holly Wyatt, and a petition, that the idea is to dissuade people from doing that by financially penalising them. Now, we've had, you know, all sorts of stuff. I mean, for example, we had the discussion and the decision at the City Council against the hiking up of rents in the city, which is something the council can't do anything about. But again, looks like they're actually doubling rents. This is a 100% hike in the rent for an allotment.
And remind me to come back to private rent, because there's something to say on that as well. But in terms of the allotments issue, I mean, this was something that sort of, I have to admit, I wasn't particularly keeping an eye on this area. It caught me completely out of the blue, but it came just after I'd heard that.
That's okay if it catches you out of the blue, because the way that the council's run these days, they keep all these things very close to their chest and then roll them out to the public, often before the councillors even get to see them.
I mean, as far as I know, this new proposal has not been through any sort of scrutiny process. It's not gone through any sort of policy development process. I don't believe, as far as I'm aware, it's gone through any sort of cabinet process. The equalities impact hasn't been assessed. The people haven't had the consultations just started for the council to start getting those views in. But I was looking through this laundry list of things that just looked horrendous. I'd appreciate, you know, money's tighter than it's ever been on the council, but to suddenly clobber people who are doing something really quite, I think, laudable with this sort of treatment, the imposition of these sorts of things, which is what it feels like is happening, it's a disgrace. The interesting thing that happened just before was that I would have to absolutely double check this to be sure, but my understanding is the council had banned people from using hose pipes on allotments, meaning people had to drag watering cans about the place. Now, that's fine if you're able-bodied. If you're elderly, if you've got mobility issues, that's effectively excluding you from being able to attend your allotment. That's disgraceful, especially if no impact assessment's been done.
Yeah, well, strict new rules would force allotment holders to remove hedges. Actually, a hedge is quite needed to keep the wind off some crops, so why should you have to remove it? Any fences are going to have to go. Of course, the fence might stop, or just even just to delineate your plot to make sure that people know where you are. It doesn't have to be a massive fence, it can be a small one, but no, you're not allowed to have one of those. Trees, even if you've got a greenhouse, you've got to remove all the glass from it and replace it with plastic.
If a really cynical person might look at something like this and go, oh, what the council might be doing here is putting out a list of absolutely horrible things that it wants to do so that when it backs down from most of them or some of them, what's left doesn't feel quite so bad. And I wouldn't want to, you know, suggest that was happening in any sort of serious way.
It sounds like the sort of conspiracy theory we talk about here all the time, actually. But anyway, yes, a raft of additional fees, including £15 for a shed. That's your shed, not their shed, but you've got to pay them £15 for it. If you've got a pond, another £15. I mean, it's just, it seems to me as if this is a rather sick joke. Greenhouse or cold frame, that's £25 for keeping chickens or bees or rabbits. £32 for a new or replacement key. And if you happen to pay a day late, you have to pay an extra £50. Setting up a tenancy would also incur a levy, £25 for individuals, £150 for any group growing together on allotments. And if you're a community interest company, doesn't matter how small your allotment is, you're going to have to pay an extra £400. So this is a cost centre. Someone's looked at this and they've gone, well, we can make more money out of this. Let's just ramp up the charges. But the effect of it is going to be actually galvanising the hatred of allotment owners against the council. But more importantly, actually, people are probably just going to walk away.
Well, this is the horrible fear, is that whether this translates into reality or not, whether this gets taken forward or not. I mean, looking at that list, I can't see anything there that I feel like I would support right now. This looks like a flat-out attack on people who are doing something good for the city and good for the environment, good for their mental health. This is terrible.
If I were Marvin Rees and I was asked about this, I might have avoided the question for quite a few weeks or months. But finally, if I was asked it, what I would say, Guy, is there's 8,000 people waiting for allotments. So we've obviously got a big demand for this. Let's get rid of some of these slovenly old allotment holders and get some new blood in.
Well, let's build some more allotments. I mean, it's part of your planning obligations. If you're a major developer and you're building housing, you're supposed to be giving the city money for allotments. Let's make sure that we're building allotments every time we can, whenever we can, and see how we do.
Martin?
Well, I don't disagree with any of that, but I think underlying all of this is the idea that councils haven't got any money. The reason they haven't got any money is because we bailed the banks out and we've just agreed another £3.5 billion for the war in the Ukraine. Sunak was over there today promising their money. And that's why, and the bankers' bonuses, they've had it because we've left the EU and so on, they had a massive Christmas bonus around in the city. The banks are still effectively, many of them, under public ownership, although we don't pretend that. And underlying all of this, we haven't got the money for things, is the fact that there's plenty of money for stuff, and this is actually a political strategy to say we haven't got any money. Yeah, and I think ultimately this is the challenge. This is where I would differ from the Greens, I suppose. You've got to challenge the fundamentals of the economic policy. It's not just about managing local resources well. Of course you've got to manage local resources well, but you've got to say, hang on a minute, local authorities simply don't have the powers that they should have to do the right thing, and they don't have the resources. And you will find, if you come to power in Bristol, that you will be faced similar constraints. You'll have to find money from somewhere. Yeah, because where we're going is we're going to end up with a situation where local authorities, many of which are going bankrupt, Birmingham's gone bankrupt, for example, they will only be able to fulfil their statutory responsibilities for social care and special needs, and they probably won't even be able to do that. And that's because all the money has been spent elsewhere on other stuff, the wrong stuff.
Now, you're a member of the Labour Party, Martin. Is this a sort of a policy that you're quite happy to see? I mean, it's almost certainly going to lose votes. I mean, we already know that there's a very definite negative feeling about the Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, just from the referendum last year. But It doesn't seem to me as if many of the policies that Marvin do is really hitting the rich and getting money off
the
rich.
Well, that's because he hasn't got the power.
The rich don't have allotments.
Yeah, but he hasn't got the power to take the money off the rich. And, of course, the central government really is the way you've got to focus the energy for that. You've got, you know, local authority. The council tax is a rubbish tax. It should never have been brought in. In Northern Ireland, they still have the rating system, because they didn't dare to introduce the poll tax in Northern Ireland. It was introduced first in Scotland, which caused basically set the SNP on the road to power and Holyrood. They introduced it then in England, which led to riots and the fall of Thatcher. They did not dare to introduce it in Northern Ireland because the private sector bailiffs that would go around take away people's tellies would have ended up dead. So they didn't do it. And of course, we should never have got rid of the rates. We should never have privatised the railways. We should, you know, I mean, I'm sorry to sound like a broken record yeah. and an old-fashioned socialist, but if you do stupid stuff, you can't do anything about it until you stop doing stupid stuff.
I think this resonates with me a lot with what Martin's saying. Don't you ever feel like you're actually swimming against the tide? The general direction is in the wrong direction. The wealthy are keeping their wealth. They're squirreling away abroad. Big companies are doing exactly the same. They're not being taxed. And so more and more of the tax burden is falling on people who can least afford to pay it.
And I would say a lot of the impact of some of the policies intended to make things better are making things worse for the people who can least afford to have things made worse for them. As Martin says, there is a huge problem in terms of central government, and we all hope that that situation will be reversed as much as it possibly can be in the current context. But at the end of the day, I'm a local councillor. I work very much in my community, and I see those wins, and they are amazing when they happen. When you can genuinely make someone's life better who is really struggling, or you can genuinely help people, that's worth it.
Let's talk about Barton House then. Because that's been a horrific issue since the middle of November, and the rather bizarre cancelling of the council meeting. Although I was told by someone who was there that one of the council officers came out and said, "I don't know why they've cancelled the meeting, because none of the people who were supposed to be going to the full council meeting officers were actually involved in dealing with Barton House on an immediate level. They could quite easily have carried on with that meeting, but they cancelled it anyway, and we had a sort of double meeting in December." And we've heard this week that at the end, I think it's in March, from memory, the people will be allowed to go back. So the whole thing was just a storm in a teacup for nothing.
You're talking to the wrong person, I'm afraid.
400 people told to leave their big council building. No actual eviction process or whatever. And they would be being put up at the Holiday Inn. And all because... I'm talking to the wrong person. But
well, I would say... I have... This is one of those areas where I have amazing colleagues, people like Yasin Mohammed, who's one of the Green councillors for Lawrence Hill, Councillor Tony Dyer for Southville, who's been hugely involved with this, and many, many, many others who have been on top of the detail of this, who have been working closely with Acorn and the residents' groups and the residents individually, as well as the council officers. They are 100% on top of this. I do not want to be the chef that spoils the broth, as it were. If they want my help, I would be happy to, but...
But you can see why the residents are angry. I've been told the place is dangerous. 400 people told to go. And some of them's just refusing and staying there, saying, "Well, we don't believe the council." And now they're being told, "Yes, actually, the ones who stayed were right. There isn't really anything particularly dangerous. It's been there since the 1950s. Nothing's really changed. So you can go back home again." It just sounds to me almost like bullying. Of the people who live there. So you're told to leave your home over Christmas. It's not really explained to you what the danger is. And then you're told it's okay, you can go back, after, 4 months or something. It just smacks to me of just incompetence. And apparently I don't know how much you know about it, Guy, but back a decade or so ago, more recently than that, around the time of Grenfell, there was a letter sent to the city council saying you must check all these buildings. The council was just changing chief executives and it got lost and it never got checked. And so it's finally, bit by bit, the proverbial has hit the fan slowly. Like, you haven't checked the building, you need to check the building. So we've ended up spending, well, it's an estimated something like £3.5 million on this. Whereas, you know, maybe for £20,000 back a few years ago, we would have been able to get it all sorted.
I mean, your heart breaks for the residents at the end of the day, that you live somewhere that where the local authority has, by implication, said for decades and decades it's safe, and then one day someone powerful says, no, it's very dangerous, you've got to get out, and then a few weeks later someone else very powerful says, no, it's fine, you can all go back in. You need to build trust with those residents in some way, and I think that trust has just been, feels to me like it's been lost completely. Looking at the last full council meeting, the level of anger that there was there, the level of frustration that was there from those residents, it's hard to know what you could say to them to ever start building up that trust. It can't be done with words. The council has to demonstrate that it's worthy of their trust again, and how they start doing that, I don't know at this point.
Yeah, Martin, this council is a fiasco, isn't it, really? And also, Guy, maybe we could talk about this week's full council meeting as well. But, Martin, what do you make of this Barton?
Well, I mean, the thing that struck me as the cherry on the cake of all of this is that they kicked these people out with no notice at all and said, you've got to carry on paying rent. I mean, that just seemed like insult to injury. If you're not going to use the building, why are you paying rent for it? I suppose that's to defray the costs of being put into the Holiday Inn or whatever. Another big problem, of course, has been all of the cladding on the buildings across Bristol, which all, of course, needs replacing and can't be replaced very easily.
Well, Paul
without
Smith,
spending
no,
huge
actually,
money.
Hang on. Paul Smith, we had on here, who resigned from Labour. Or, sorry, retired.
He didn't retire from Labour, he resigned from the council.
Resigned from the council. He's still in the Labour Party, like you are. Amazingly, bravely, or stupidly, some might say. But what he was saying was that what were we talking about? Why did I mention?
I was talking about the cladding.
Yeah, he said actually, cladding. Check the cladding is okay here in Bristol.
Well, I understood that there was
that was on his watch.
I understood that there's a problem with the cladding. They can't remove it and change it. So they've actually paid. I mean, I may have got this wrong. This is just what's, I may have got aspects of this wrong. But anyway, the point is that there's all of these kind of unforeseen things that can happen after the Grenfell disaster. They suddenly look at all this cladding and think, oh, no, there isn't just one lot of cladding. It's all over the place. And, of course, it's because it's doing... in Kensington, where they did it, there were two reasons. A, it was cheap, and B, they didn't want to just leave it without cladding because they wanted it to... because it affected the house prices of the people who live nearby. So they put cladding on it to make it look more friendly to the people, you know, because people buying houses nearby, and their house prices were affected.
Okay, so anyway, Guy, if housing is not your brief, what is?
I know a bit about housing. Barton House is one that where it's a really specific case, and I wouldn't want to say anything about the details of that one specifically because I just don't know. But I'm more than happy to talk about housing.
Yeah, what are the Greens going to do when they take over in May?
Right homes in the right places. I think this is a really, really key thing. Like, I sit on one of those planning committees as well. In fact, I sit on that specific planning committee that we were talking about a moment ago. And I was dealing with a case from my ward just a few weeks ago now. This was a guy who'd bought an old derelict property that was a fly-tipping hotspot. It was falling apart. He was keen to build 8 flats on that site. And he'd been strung along for 2 years by the local authority, who were talking about things like the pleasing line of fenestration at the front of the property. And it was the most baroque reasons that they'd just delayed and delayed and delayed this build. And at the same time, you see these massive planning applications that are going to make people millionaires. That provide low quality,
excuse me,
or billionaires,
yeah.
To provide low quality, badly designed housing all over the city, where the city council is bending over backwards to try and get these rushed
well,
through.
Well, your small development applicant is obviously not shaking the right hands in the right manner. Because certainly my understanding of the planning system is if you're within the Masonic Lodge and you know the right people and you're shaking the right hands, you will have no trouble and the system will work for you. Now, I'm not saying that you're part of that, but, I mean, you surely feel the commercial pressure on that planning committee. And there's also a tension between those committees and the mayor's office, isn't there? The mayor's office is often trying to push these developments while the planning committee is trying to be independent.
Yeah, I mean, the planning committee is supposed to be completely apolitical. It's quasi-judicial process. You know, you leave your party at the door when you go in. But equally, you get some quite bizarre statements from the mayor and from even from some cabinet members as well. I remember there was one when, you know, two Greens voted, or three Greens possibly even voted different ways on a planning application, and we had tweets coming out of saying, oh, the Greens are all over the place. So, well, no, the Greens are making a judgment based on the evidence in front of them independently. That's what we're all supposed to be doing here. We're not supposed to be whipped. We're not supposed to be facing the same way. But that commercial pressure is huge in the city. And at the end of the day, if you want to build good quality homes for people, you need a really good process there. You need a good policy that really, you know, sweats the developers to make sure that you get environmentally sustainable, high quality, affordable housing for the people that need it, rather than designing our entire housing stock around the needs of private investment.
Well, student flats, does that count as housing, I suppose?
For the targets, John, I honestly don't know. What I can tell you is that my own ward, the council has a policy that's supposed to be managing houses in multiple occupation. They've completely lost control of. There are areas that are now 50% HMOs. The total number of students at the university combined has grown, I think, by about 20,000 people under this mayor. There's your housing crisis. God, is that roughly the number of people that kicked off the housing waiting list in recent memory?
Well, that's right, but kicked off the housing waiting. This is another point, isn't it? This is one way to deal with the housing crisis, is to get your housing waiting list and chop it in half and throw one half in the bin.
I mean, I remember that being pushed on the council back in 2010. There's still not the ambition, I don't think, to build the right kind of housing in the right kind of places. So you just end up with this constant conflict between, at the end of the day, local communities that want to protect their quality of life and, generally speaking, aren't actually that opposed to new housing coming in. What they don't want is giant, badly built, badly designed developments that take resource away from the local community rather than bringing it in.
Well, it's very difficult to get them to build in infrastructure. You know, they're quite happy to build and sell little rabbit hutch houses everywhere, but get them to build a shopping centre, a church, a school, almost hopeless, really. We must look also, I think, at this sort of the way that the full council meetings seem to be degenerating. I mean, this is the second full council meeting held, is it Tuesday this week? Where the whole proceedings had to be brought to a halt because people shouting from the public gallery. Were you there for that one?
Do you know what? I wasn't, actually. I was at that council meeting. I went out for 5 minutes, make a phone call, came back in and found all of my colleagues in the room next door. And so I don't know what happened immediately before, but, yeah, it's the previous full council meeting.
Well, luckily, our local democracy reporter was...
Ah!
Well, I say our. These people are fantastic. I love them. Adam and...
Alex.
Alex, Seabrook. That's right. And hecklers caused Bristol councillors to stop debate on calling for ceasefire in the Gaza war. This was the second full council meeting in a row to be adjourned due to disruption and heckling. In fact, the Gaza war did come up in the previous meeting too. But Labour's Mayor Marvin Rees, as response to the council meeting being halted by the Lord Mayor, and by the heckler, in order to remove the heckler, I suppose, Marvin Rees said, "It feels odd to have to point out that I'm not actually driving the Middle East conflict." Well, I'm not sure anyone was saying that he was driving the Middle East conflict, but so I don't know why he says that. While making statements is important for our own domestic politicians and populations, it doesn't influence what will go on overseas. Well, this is rich coming from Marvin, who's the mayor who seems to want to travel the world, giving his view on climate and doing TED Talks, being at there was another big meeting he was at recently, which escapes me. He's jetting around the world, putting Bristol on the global map, and there he is backtracking, saying, "Well, it's got nothing to do with our local population. Therefore, why are we talking about it?"
I don't want to speak to this mayor's priorities. I've not really understood what this mayor's priorities are. But no, I appreciate what you're saying. It seems completely counterintuitive to be flying all over the world to talk about climate change. Although that said, I think it was actually Alex Seabrook put that question to him, and subsequently was uninvited from
those
future press calls.
Bizarre. Martin, what's going on? I mean, hopefully this system's going to be gone soon. This is the second full council meeting in a row that had to be adjourned due to disruption and heckling from the public gallery. We're now in the situation, aren't we, Guy? And I don't know what you make of this. We'll hear from Martin first. Now we're having bans. So individual members of the public the main reason that they're shouting usually is because they put a question in and they're being told, no, you can't ask the question. So they start shouting, why can't I ask the question? This sort of thing. Or shouting the question when they've been told you're not allowed to say it. And now these people are being banned for 6 months from coming into the council house.
Well, I think it's rather strange that Marvin should say that, because he must have been behind the decision to project the Israeli flag onto the council house after the October the 7th massacre, war, whatever you want to call it. So in other words, that was uncontroversial. And of course, Palestine Solidarity in Bristol, they projected the Palestinian flag onto the council house at the full council meeting. I think this idea that we can ignore international affairs when we're talking about what goes on in Bristol is wrong, because it's at local level that people assume, you know, they do their political activism for obvious reasons. And, you know, if you look at what's happened in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline being blown up by the Americans in the Baltic Sea, I mean, Seymour Hersh is a very, very experienced journalist. He's been at the top of the profession in the US all of his life, and his insiders have told him what happened. It was blown up by a US Navy dive team. Now, that, in fact, wrecks the whole of the German economy, which then wrecks the whole of the European economy. It affects the Russians, but not to the same extent. Now, what's the point of talking about local politics in Bristol when the whole European economy is pushed into depression by a deliberate act by the Americans? Now, that is, I mean, I have to admit, I am more interested in international politics than housing.
And
They're all linked.
The other thing to say here, I think, important to say, is we've got an amazing international community here.
That's right, from people from all over the world in Bristol.
Here in Bristol, and it's one of the things I like to do, is if there's something happening in that part of the world, let's get a Bristolian who's born in that part of the world, or from a culture from that part of the world. I think we had a memorable chat with Pakistani community, Farooq Siddiq, I think is his name. About what's going on in Pakistani politics with Imran Khan. You know, we've got an amazing benefit, really, of having all these people from all around the world in the city.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, Bristol's City of Sanctuary status is something we should be hugely proud of, but it does give us that international sort of insight, and brings it into the heart of the culture of the city. It's something we should absolutely be treasuring.
What about migration? You think that's an economic migration?
I think it's been overwhelmingly positive for the city as a whole. I think there's always a huge challenge with anything. I want to be really, really careful what I say, because I don't want to misrepresent my position here, but I do think there is an extent to which very often the benefits of migration aren't fully shared within the city as a whole, and that has led to resentment in some pockets of the city as well. And I don't think it's,
I mean, isn't it partly a divide and rule tactic? You bring in loads of migrants and then you set poor people of different coloured skins against each other. I mean, the Brits have been experts at this divide and rule tactic for centuries.
I mean, you look at an institution like the NHS that in effect only functioned and only functions now, such as it is, off the back of a huge number of people who were not born in the UK and who have come to the UK and work incredibly hard in the UK to make that public institution function. They work phenomenally hard to do so. The idea that immigration's been a net problem for the NHS is laughable. It's for the birds. But that's not to say if you're waiting for a doctor's appointment, or it's very easy for a government to point at, or a racist organisation to point at immigration and say, "Oh, it's because of those people," and that we see that happen. You know, that's been the far right's tactic for a very, very long time.
Well, of course, the money's not there because of the austerity policy as a result of banking collapses and all the rest of it, and therefore there are longer queues.
Mm.
Yeah, but the Brits have also been very, very good. I mean, you know, this is, I say good, the idea of cheap labour. I mean, they love cheap labour, and of course migrants are cheap labour.
Not always, Tony.
Yes, they are, yeah.
Most of the people coming in at the moment have even got visas, yeah, and they've actually got to be have a job that pays
but
more.
But people
than,
come over
than,
here
than,
to
than
do jobs, to undercut particular... so it's a way of bringing people in and not paying... British people a decent wage, isn't it? Surely another
Tony,
technique.
That's a misrepresentation, because in actual fact, if we were to increase the pay in the care sector, which we should do, we should probably double it, but we're not prepared to do that because we've got to go to war in the Ukraine and we've got to bend
but
the banks.
But it's not our
loyalty.
Decision. These are private businesses.
No, the private businesses. No, the private businesses, they work on what the government decides they're going to pay for care workers. So it's not actually a private decision at all. It's what the government decides what care workers are going to be paid. Now, they could double the pay for care workers, and that would mean massive increases in taxes on wealthy people who don't use the NHS. And many Tory voters will not vote for that because they don't want
more taxes. I mean, this whole business of social care has just not been dealt with, Guy, is it? Have the Greens got any thoughts on social care, how to deal with it, how to pay for it?
Again, I'm in no way an expert on that particular policy area, so I wouldn't even know where to start talking about the Green Party policy in that area.
Being so slippery there.
I genuinely don't know. No, okay, it's out there. Enough. It's online. You'll be able to find it.
It's a massive thing that needs to be dealt with, and it requires
Martin,
a huge
amount. Martin, how would you deal with it? Come on, then.
You need to spend a lot. You need to double the money paid to care workers, and then lots more British people would be prepared to do those jobs.
And I would certainly be in favour of. I'm 99% sure my party would be as well. At the end of the day, everyone deserves a living wage. And one of the things I see quite frequently is when you get organisations that subcontract to organisations that will then claim that their workers are self-employed. You look at the amount of work that these people are doing versus the number of hours they're actually being paid for, and it never stacks. It's a disgrace, and we need to be enforcing the law around.
Yeah, but I mean, but when you're thinking about things like lorry drivers and bus drivers, they are mostly now in the private sector, and so the price of them goes up because there's a shortage and their wages increase. But in the care sector, although it's largely privatised, the amount of money private companies who run the care sector can get is dependent on what the government is prepared to pay for care. And they just don't want to spend the money. They don't want to spend the money on prisons, which is why the prisons are overcrowded and all the rest of it. They don't want to spend the money on all the social things we need because they want to spend it on other stuff. They want to spend it on themselves, skiing holidays and wars with brown people.
And I would be absolutely remiss if I also didn't mention, because this is something that gets left out of this conversation way too often, the huge, huge number of people, but overwhelmingly, particularly women, who'd simply never get paid for the care work that they do, be that caring for family members. Yeah, the work that's just not considered part of the economy by our society.
So good for GDP, making this into something that people pay to do rather than they just do it because they care about people in their own families. I mean, this is one of the problems, I think, over the years, is a lot of the things that people would do in their spare time, their overheads as a family are so high that they don't have the spare time to care for an elderly person, for example. So I don't think it's a good thing at all to be saying, well, this is something that we can use to boost our GDP by making sure that every bit of care that's given to somebody is paid for.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, but I do think that the impact of that, you know, that social kind of norm that there is some kind of work, there are some kinds of work that we think of as being, you know, suitable for pay, and some that just get ignored. As part of that conversation, that the impact of that is felt massively disproportionately by women.
Well, one of the super things about Bristol is that we've actually got quite a lot of Palestinians living here. They, I think, have been probably more shocked than almost anybody else about what's been going on. Maybe not, actually. Maybe they've been seeing this coming. And we had a terrific meeting at the Palestine, I think it's called the Palestine Embassy, Palestine Museum. on Sunday with journalists meeting some of them, and one of them is a lady called Khadija Abujnam. She used to be part of the steering committee of Muslims in the city, and they also brought some people and academics from London to talk to local journalists, which was an extremely good thing to do. There was, by the way, on Friday night, a bomb scare at the Palestine Museum, which led to 40 police searching the place from top to bottom. This is on Broad Street, right in the city centre, with explosive sniffer dogs. This email had said that their bombs were planted throughout the building and were due to go off on Saturday, hence the urgency of the police operation there. And it's interesting that the people at the museum and the police decided not to publicise it because they're saying, well, you know, this sort of thing encourages copycats. But the thing is, Martin, we hear quite a lot, don't we, about similar things to do with synagogues and Jewish schools, bomb scares, bomb threats all the time.
Well, obviously, this is a very tense situation, and lots of communities are feeling threatened or under or attacked. And of course, you know, that's got to be dealt with.
I think the police did a superb job, by the way, getting straight in there as soon as they realised there had been this threat, and just searching the place from top to bottom with these explosive sniffer dogs, just to make sure there was really nothing there. Yeah. And of course, the meeting on Sunday went away. One of the questions I put to the panel, in fact, to this lady particularly, Khadija, was, does she think, and this, I think this is an important point, it'd be interesting to see what you make of this on Gaza in a minute, Guy. Is it actually a religious conflict between Jews and Muslims?
It's not about religion. As Muslims in Bristol, Palestinian Muslims and Palestinian Christians, they're Palestinian Christians as well, we have no problem with the Jewish community. Nowadays we can see that there's trying to introduce laws to link anti-Zionism. We believe that they're different, also anti-Semitic, and as Firas mentioned, there was no issue with anti-Semitism in Arabic Brothers and Arab Jews. They didn't face this. This is something European, and I believe that, and we reassure again, we don't have an issue with the Jewish community. It shouldn't be turned a religion against a religion.
Well, and she's basically saying, no, it's, sorry about the sound quality there, but they were quite funny about me putting a microphone up at the front. They didn't want me to record there. But what she's saying, Guy, is that this is nothing to do with religion, and that she and other Muslims have no problem with Jews at all.
It's a horrendous situation. I this is not something I feel qualified particularly to talk about, other than my heart goes out to the victims of violence that I've seen. It's become almost impossible to watch the news without feeling like you're on the edge of a breakdown on this particular issue, and it's
20,000 well, that's what we do words here, and 20,000 at least dead, probably 22,000 Palestinians dead, as against the estimates are around about 120 Israelis attacked on October the 7th or killed, and many more, of course, since. This doesn't seem to be proportionate, is my point, really. And that Gaza and West Bank and the occupation of Palestine seems to have been a running sore for decades, really, ever since us good old Brits handed it over to Ben Gurion in 1947 and 1948.
Obviously, this is turning into a very, very serious international crisis. And, of course, with the news that we had today about Britain and the US...
We'll be talking about that
obviously, we're going to get into more detail later on. I think whether it's a religious conflict or not... I mean, the Zionism was not originally a religious movement. It was a nationalist movement. It was based around Jewish identity, rather than... And a lot of them were quite secular or even atheist. On the Palestinian side, they were not particularly religious to begin with. I mean, their opposition, Fatah is a secular organisation, Hamas less so. But of course, it isn't just Hamas which are effectively the elected government of Palestine. They won the last election in 2006. They weren't allowed to take power in the West Bank because the Israelis in the West prevented it. They got Mohammed Dahlan in to try and take over in Gaza, and they weren't able to. And Hamas was stronger than they were. But Hamas, the recent opinion polls have been carried out in Palestine, and Hamas's popular support has massively increased, even though there's a massive death toll. Because I think the Palestinian population have realised that this is their moment to rise up. As I've said before, what Winston Churchill said in 1940.
Martin, what are they going to rise up with? They don't have an army or anything, do they?
No, the Hamas fighters in the tunnels inside Gaza are giving the Israeli army conscripts a very hard time. And they're not actually winning.
But I really,
Hezbollah is also causing...
Try and get some response from Guy on this, really. Yeah. Because, for example, I don't know how to put this. Would you class it as a genocide, what's going on? Because the response seems to be overwhelmingly attacks on hospitals, schools, and on civilians.
It feels to me like an area where every fact is disputed, every claim is challengeable. If I put myself in the shoes of a Palestinian, you have this horrific body count. You have what seem to be siege tactics being legitimised. You have water being cut off and turned back on. It looks and feels like a war crime from some of the things that I've heard and read, and those things are then challenged by other sources who can also seem credible. And at the same time, I put myself in the shoes of an Israeli, or I try to put myself in the shoes of an Israeli. I don't know how I would sleep at night until I knew that the forces that had committed the atrocities that we saw a few months ago were gone. I don't know. I don't feel qualified to talk about it. I'm really sorry. I see things that are heartbreaking constantly on both sides.
I suppose the fact is, we are Brits, aren't we? And this is a problem which is a legacy of Britain.
Oh, I mean, the legacy of empire is horrific in so many different ways. And it's...
Anyway, look, we're going to finish. Sorry. Not on that. No, it's okay. What about the projection of the Israeli flag colours on the council house by the council? And then afterwards it was the Palestinian protesters that projected the Palestinian colours. So there was an attempt at balance, but not really by the council.
I mean, for what it's worth, I don't know who made that decision. I think it was sort of a half... alleged earlier that the mayor must have had a hand in it. I don't know if that's the case, actually. An awful lot of what happens at City Hall seems to happen by sort of, by process, as it were.
It just happens. No one will take accountability for it at all. It's just happened, and no one's going to say who decided to do it. Very much like a kind of corporation. This is the way corporations work. Anyway, look, we're going to just wind up, Guy. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about? Any kind of beefs you've got or... things that you think we should. I mean, we've covered quite a lot there, but I wonder if we missed anything.
It feels very difficult to go back to the issues that might feel trivial in comparison. No, I mean, it's just to say, you know, Bristol's been my home now for a very long time, and I was on the council sort of 2009-2013 period before, and then came back, and the city council looks and feels so different after this sort of long period of mayoral governments. I talked to members of staff who seem genuinely to be doing their best, but everything feels so stretched, everything feels so strained, everything feels so broken. I my hat goes off to the council officers very often that you know, anyone who's working on the front line for Bristol City Council is doing an amazing thing. Most councillors, I would say, from all parties are trying their best. It's a horrendous, you know, budgetary situation that the council's in. But I'm genuinely, sincerely hopeful that come May, that new form of accountability, that, you know, that the way that the council works will force councillors to work together. And I think at the moment, if you go to any council committee, you'll see a much, much better representation of the work that your elected politicians do than you'll see in full council, which is a very sort of pantomimey kind of affair. And my hope is that culture will just inform a better, more understanding, more listening and more effective city council come May. That's my hope.
Well, yes, so everyone's hope here too. So finally, Fujitsu, let's go back to this, handed a £3.6 billion in government contracts on Rishi Sunak's watch. One of the most shocking things about the, if you can use the word shocking, on the documentary about the post office scandal was the one of the investigators walking into the Fujitsu headquarters and seeing somebody remotely accessing these Horizon terminals in some post office, distant post office somewhere, where they obviously did have, Fujitsu did have access. Another question that doesn't really seem to have been addressed is, where did the money go that was stolen from these people? They were accused of themselves of stealing. What happened to that money? Did it go from one? Did it disappear into a black hole? Did it go into another bank account? Because it's quite feasible that somebody, Fujitsu or somebody working with them, was just literally logging into these computers and stealing money and putting it into different accounts. So that really doesn't seem to have been properly looked at. But we can wind up by looking at one of the most horrendous aspects of all of this, which is Fujitsu signed a £48 million deal in 2022, 2 years ago, to maintain the police national computer, which stores details of all convictions and cautions and fingerprint and DNA data. In 2021, an error in the system led to the loss of nearly 500,000 records. So Fujitsu apparently are now also in charge of our police national computer data, Martin.
Well, it's what I've said before about contracting out. If you get the culture of the civil service used to be that we will do stuff in-house. You know, if we need to train our own people to develop a computer system, that's what we will do. But once you've got the culture, it's cheaper and better, and they know what to do. You're bringing subcontractors in, you lose control. Now, it may be that the other system would be slow and bureaucratic, but at least you would know who was responsible, the lines of responsibility would be clear, and you'd keep the skills involved with running computers in the public.
You know what
sector.
This reminds me of? 9/11. I don't know if you remember the computers that the United States NORAD was using, their air defence, was saying, hang on, there's a blip appeared on my screen. Is that real world or is it an exercise?
Well, that was all presumably public sector.
They were
NORAD.
There were back doors into these computers where fake traces of aircraft
you're missing the point, because
what I'm saying is all of these computer systems have got their back doors.
They have, and that's a problem for that's a military problem, which you will see that the Ukrainians and the Russians are very aware of. The electronic warfare stuff that's going on over there is the most advanced in the world. Everybody's hacking everything else. And of course, if it's life and death, you really need to get it right.
What about money? You know, that's what this much of this could have been. Anyway, Guy, what do you make of this? Fujitsu's not just been in charge of the post offices; it's also got this £48 million deal 18 months ago to maintain the police national computer.
Well, and sorry, I had assumed you were bringing this back to Bristol because it's a kind of breaking story. There's a current issue going on. One of my colleagues, David Wilcox, one of the councillors for Lockleys, but also chairs the council's Growth and Regeneration Scrutiny Commission that's looking at this. There was a Bristol City Council deal last year where the council paid just shy of £1 million. However, the original decision was made at officer level rather than cabinet level, because initially it was estimated the contract was only worth £118,000, which is less than the threshold that would make it a formal cabinet or mayoral decision. So this is something that we're going to need to urgently scrutinise ourselves locally, like now.
This is Fujitsu.
The Fujitsu. Timing could not have been worse for the council.
What are Fujitsu doing here in Bristol then? I mean, you're reading this off your phone. Is this on one of the local news websites or what?
It is. A credit to, Alex Seabrook again.
Marvin's nemesis.
I'll be really honest with you. The reason I was checking on my phone was because I heard about it and I wasn't sure if it was confidential or not.
Oh, okay.
But having seen it on the Bristol Live website, or Bristol Post website, it's I feel comfortable talking about it.
So tell us about it, please. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. It's so decisions that are... at a certain threshold of expenditure, a money must be made by someone who's politically accountable, be that cabinet member or cabinet collectively or by the mayor, but it can't just be nodded through by officers. This was on the grounds that it was only worth £118,000, but the information we've now got is that the council's paid Fujitsu Services Limited almost £900,000. I don't want to quote Alex quite directly, but it transpires that the audit committee, the first time we heard about the appointment of Fujitsu was September last year. And they'd apparently been on board since well, New Year 2023. So, yeah, February time. So, yeah, this is just one of those cases, I'm afraid, where the council suddenly become topical for rather the worst imaginable reasons. Just as everyone's talking about the failure of these systems at the post office, it transpires that we're using them as well.
So what are we using them for?
Well, this is what I'm now very keen to find out, but I'm sure it'll be coming to audit and scrutiny now that we know about it.
So maybe we just don't know yet. So anyway, thanks ever so much for that. We're going to finish, though, in part one, with a poem by Patrizia Opulenza, who's written her poem this week. Is called Somewhere Over the Horizon. Fat cats in high places, now shaking in their shoes. Theft and many dodgy deals, while innocents accused. Government, Fujitsu, post office, all committing crimes, while thousands of sub-postmasters lost 20 years of their time. Shortfalls in abundance, the post office beyond the pale. Repayments demanded and sent folks off to jail. Mr. Bates, sub-postmaster, refused to toe the line or be accused of stealing or committing any crimes. Ms. Thompson from Computer Weekly wrote a story on this truth, blew the whistle on the scam, the beginning of the sleuths. MPs contacted, but many didn't care. Lord Arbuthnot, a good MP, these findings he would share. Forensic accountants all in earnest with a view to the bottom they would get of this murky do. Fat cats at Fujitsu, post office, blood on hands, suicides and many deaths, dirty money, filthy brands, false accounting and the rest hidden in the stew. Lies, as many told since then, a vile concocted brew. Super users protected, investigators all were sacked. What was really going on cash in pockets racked? Covert operations, remote access, all prolonged, blaming, shaming, naming. So many people wronged, a cover-up of such magnitude. How a payoff underway. Whilst those behind the scam of scams still live it up each day, no justice is really done when mobsters at the top decide to carve our country up. It never seems to stop. Tony Blair involved, as per showed, he had Horizon's back. Regardless of the myth, the truth he knew, this system could be hacked. Hush-ups now are plenty, all hidden and out of view. Those behind this travesty will walk away, it is true. Pressure from on faces to make this problem go. Watch these devils clamour to say they didn't know what was really going on some 20 years ago. Lives destroyed, suicides, families broken up and more. Fat cats live it larger, while innocents all swore. Ill-gotten gains, suspense accounts, uphold their bottom line. All stolen from the victims of this putrid crime.
Charity. on a bright May morning like a hero in a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flood meadow or the house that I once knew. No trace of that little river or the garden where I grew. I saw town and I saw country, motorway and sink estate. Rich man in his rolling acres, poor man still outside the gate. Retail park and burger kingdom, prairie field and factory farm, run by men who think that England's only a place to park their car. As the train pulled from the station through the wastelands of despair, from the corner of my eye a brightness filled the filthy air. Someone sown a patch of sunflowers, though the soil is sooty black. Marigolds and a few tomatoes right beside the railway track. Behind the terraced houses, in between the concrete towers, compost heaps and scarlet runners, secret gardens full of flowers. Lita grows her scented roses right beneath the big jet's path. Bid a fortune for her garden, Eileen turns away and laughs. Rise up, George, and wake up, Arthur. Time to rouse out from your sleep. Deck the horse with sea-green ribbons. Drag the old sword from the deep. Hold the line for Dave and Daniel as they tunnel through the clay, while the oak in all its glory sucks up sun for one more day. Come all you at home with freedom, whatever the land that gave you birth. There's room for you, both root and branch, as long as you love the English earth. Room for bowl and room for orchid, room for all to grow and thrive. Just less room for the fat landowner on his arse in his four-wheel drive. Not flag or empire, it is not money and it is not blood. It's limestone gorge and granite fell, it's weald and clay and seven mud. It's blackbird singing from the may tree, lark ascending through the scales, robin watching from your spade, and English earth beneath your nails. Here's two cheers for a place called England, sore abused but not yet dead. A Mr. Harding saw to England, hanging in there by a thread. Here's two cheers for the crazy diggers, now their hour shall come around. We shall plant the seed they saved us, Commonwealth and common ground. For the crazy diggers, now their hour is come around. We shall plant the seed they saved as Commonwealth and common ground.
June Tabor and 1999, A Place Called England. Before that we had, oh, I can remember listening to that at school, 1977 I guess it would have been, The Stranglers, No More Heroes, and listening to it thinking, wow, this is good, this is good. We were really treated, weren't we, the late 70s, particularly, with some incredible stuff churning out week after week. What on earth happened to that industry? It just got destroyed, didn't it? Well, it's not an industry. It was just, it was a, like a gigantic art centre all over West London, mainly, creating brilliant stuff. So well done to the Strangler. Like, you know, don't love every single one of their songs, but that, and I'll do is I'll pop some more Stranglers, I think, on at the end of the show when we upload it later tonight. Before all that, what was it? That was the Staple Singers, Going Away, from the 1970s too. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to plunge straight in to look at this interesting development last night with the British war cabinet. No, actually what they are is COBRA, isn't it? Meeting on Zoom. And I don't know if that's partly the cabinet, partly not. And apparently, Martin, Grant Shapps has now declared war on Yemen.
Yes, it's quite shocking. It's not, it doesn't surprise me that this has happened. But look, if you think about it in terms of process in Britain, Keir Starmer was brought in, no doubt, to rubber stamp the whole process. But if you think of the implications of the Chilquat inquiry, where they shouldn't declare war on anybody without a vote in Parliament. Now, what they've done here, and the same, they've done the same in the US, because the US Constitution demands that a Congress is convened to discuss going to war. But in actual fact, Biden and Sunak and Starmer have decided to start a war against the constitutions of both Britain and the United States, and of course, nobody else is interested.
Hang on, in the Reagan era, didn't they say, actually, this is not practical because the president needs to have this power?
Well, yes, but at the same time, there's been pushback against that as a result.
And here in Britain, this wouldn't be able to go ahead if it hadn't been for the armed forces going along with it.
I'm just saying that the
chief of the general staff, King Charles.
Yes, I know.
Just a minute, King Charles, chief of the general staff. These are the people would have to go along with it, wouldn't they, in order for this to happen? And that is not the cabinet. That's a bunch of people who are actually in charge here.
Yes, but the Chilquat report, the Chilquat inquiry, said we mustn't have a situation where we go to war without proper consultation. And that's why Ed Miliband refused to go along with attacking Syria after the so-called chemical weapons attack at Douma, which turned out to be a false flag by the White Helmets, which were run by MI6. Now, I don't suppose Miliband really knew all the details of that, but he wasn't prepared to go along with it. And at that point, David Cameron couldn't order an attack. What they've done here is they've done it all in the dead of night so that there can't be any consultation about it. And of course,
well, no, that's not why. I mean, it might well be because they're attacking places where if they did it during the daytime, there'd be somebody there who would be killed.
No, the decision was done in the dead of night is what I'm saying. There's no particular rush to do this. And, of course, they tried to get a coalition of the willing to get involved. I noticed the list of countries which say they're supporting this Operation Prosperity Guardian includes Australia, but it doesn't include New Zealand. It includes Bahrain, which, of course, is a dictatorship by the Sunni Al-Khalifa family against the Shia majority in Bahrain. And, of course, Bahrainis could find themselves under attack now by the Shia, by Nasrullah. And the obvious thing to say about this is if you wanted to keep the Red Sea trade route open, the last thing you need is an all-out war in the Red Sea.
Well, I mean, it is urgent.
It's just idiotic.
Martin, it is urgent because HMS Diamond, which is, I think, a guided missile destroyer, is it, in the Red Sea, Royal Navy, was earlier this week attacked. So let's have a listen to that report now.
The government today vowed the West could step up its action if an Iranian-backed rebel group continues to target international shipping using the Suez Canal. The warning from the Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, came after UK and US naval forces in the Red Sea destroyed a large-scale drone attack launched by Houthi rebels who are based in Yemen, attacks which the Houthis claim are in response to Israel's bombardment of Gaza.
This is the moment British naval forces attacked the largest drone and missile strike by the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. HMS Diamond joins a gathering international presence in the Red Sea, alarmed at how Iran and its allies are trying to disrupt one of the most vital sea routes for the global economy. This extraordinary, almost Hollywood-like video shot by the Houthi rebels shows them landing on the cargo ship Galaxy Leader and taking its crew hostage. Tonight, the Houthis and their Iranian sponsors say the attacks are in retaliation for Israel's war in Gaza. In reality, it's much more about causing commercial chaos for Western economies who so heavily rely on the Red Sea and Suez Canal. This is why we have got involved, because disrupted and more expensive supply chains hits every family in the UK.
Simplest thing is to say, watch this space. We cannot have a situation where a major sea route, a major ability to move goods around the world, is being cut off by terrorists and thugs, and we therefore must act.
That message was backed up by the US Secretary of State, who is in the region.
If these attacks continue, as they did yesterday, there will be consequences. Again, this represents a clear threat to the interests of countries around the world.
And those consequences, in order to protect commercial shipping that Western economies rely on, are already being felt. Raghu Omar, News at 10.
So that's ITV's report from earlier in the week, Wednesday, I believe. The HMS Diamond came under a concerted attack in the Red Sea from the Houthis, including, I heard in one report, an anti-ship ballistic missile, the sort of thing that could have taken the ship out completely. But they've got some sort of defence system on there that sends out some sort of little missiles to try and take these drones and ballistic anti-ship missiles out as they're on the way in, Martin. So, in a way, it could well be that HMS Diamond could have ended up at the bottom of the Red Sea earlier this week.
It may still do so. What was happening was that the Houthis were attacking commercial shipping on its way to Israel, and they were getting information about which ships were on their way to Israel, because they were getting inside information, in open source,
at the south end of the Bab al-Mandeb of the Red Sea. What the Yemenis have control half of that, the narrows there, was saying, well, look, if this ship coming into the Bab al-Mandeb has got anything to do with Israel, it's not coming through.
That's right. And in actual fact,
it's going to have to go round.
Various Chinese ships have been going through because they're not sailing to Israel.
Or they may have nothing to do with it. Yeah. So they're filtering it. They're basically like a little customs station at the end
of
the Red Sea.
That's right. Don't forget, they control that. It's like us controlling the channel. They control that.
So it's a bit like having maybe a Yemeni Houthi destroyer sitting in the channel saying who can and cannot go. And that's why they're annoyed about having this HMS Diamond and the American ships there.
Yeah, well, they are what they've decided to do, and it's actually very popular inside Yemen. It's not unpopular. Don't forget, the Yemenis have been taking nearly a decade of bombings and blockades from Saudi Arabia, backed up by the Americans and the British. The British are based in Riyadh, helping the Saudis to kill Yemeni children. They have been for many years. And of course, there's actually the Anas ruler has actually got a grudge against the British, because they have been supporting their enemies inside Yemen. And this actually goes back to the British Empire time, because
not really. Look, let's be honest about it. Look, there was quite a reasonable settlement when the British withdrew in Empire days. What's happened is there's been an 8-year war supported by the British of Saudi Arabia on Yemen. That's what's really got their going.
Yes, but I mean, even before that, Tony, if you look at the history, you will find that British special forces were involved in trying to overthrow the government of Yemen after we withdrew in 1967. So the Yemenis know the British of old.
This is about the British support for the Saudis over the last 8 years.
Yes, of course it is.
Massively.
All right.
Most people have forgotten about those things from days gone by, but what they've really
Yemenis
annoyed
haven't.
Them... What? Yes, they have. Most
have
of
they?
What's really, yes.
I don't
what's
think
really,
they have,
What's
Tony.
Really annoyed them is this support by the British for the Saudi attack on their country
That's
over the last
right.
8 years.
And
the Americans.
And the final straw is the support for the British and the Americans for the massacre in Gaza. And of course, the government of Yemen, which the Houthis regard themselves as, and they control 70% of the population, the areas that are out of their control are not, they are basically, they control most of the population, don't control most of the area. They are actually very much in favour of taking the Palestinian side,
anyway,
because they've taken so much punishment. I mean, what's really triggered this is the killing of 10 Yemeni sailors by the Americans. That was the first blood that was shed. And they killed 10 Yemeni sailors. They all went to, they were all buried with full military honours and all the rest of it. And the, Nasrullah said, now we're going to take this out on you. The British and the Americans have killed Yemeni service people. Now it's time for British and American service people to die.
Rather than you and I pontificating, let's have a listen to the Yemenis themselves. And this is the spokesperson for, Yemen's Houthi armed forces. His name is Yahya Sari. So let's have a listen to what he's got to say.
Interrupting our programming to take you live to Yemen, where the spokesman for the Houthi armed forces is giving a statement after US and British forces carried out strikes against Houthi targets. Let's listen in.
The response: the Yemeni armed forces will not hesitate to target the origin of any threat and all enemy targets in land and on the sea to defend Yemen's sovereignty and independence. This belligerence cannot dent the Yemeni armed forces from their purpose supporting the Palestinian people. We, the armed forces of Yemen, will continue to prevent the Israeli vessels or those headed to the occupied Palestinian territories from navigating in the Arab Sea or the Red Sea. God is our rock, and long live Yemen, independent and free. Victory to Yemen and all free men worldwide. This is in Sana'a on the 12th of January 2024, a statement issued by the Yemeni armed forces. He who starts an aggression against you should be fought against. The American British enemy, in the context of the support to the Israel's criminal act in Gaza, launched a belligerence against the Republic of Yemen with 73 airstrikes targeting Sana'a, Hodeida, Taiz, and Saada. These airstrikes claimed the lives of 5 and caused 6 to be injured from among the ranks of our armed forces. The British-American enemy is held totally liable for their criminal belligerence against our Yemeni people. This belligerence cannot go unpunished. This cannot go without a response. The Yemeni armed forces will not hesitate to target the origin of any threats, together with all enemy targets in the land or on the sea, to defend Yemen's sovereignty and independence. This belligerence aggression cannot dent the Yemeni armed forces from supporting the Palestinian people. The Yemeni armed forces reiterate they will continue to prevent Israeli vessels or those headed to the occupied Palestinian seaport from navigating in the Arab or the Red Sea. And God is our rock, and He is a disposer of all affairs. Long live Yemen, free and independent. Victory to Yemen and all free men worldwide. Issued in Sana'a, the 1st of Rajab, 1445 Hijri, the 12th of January 2024, a statement issued by the Yemeni armed forces.
Well, you see, what they've done is they've cemented the support for Nasrullah. They've not carried out any kind of attack because they're so decentralized. There's no big bases for them to hit. And don't forget, they've learned their tactics.
When you say Nasrullah, you mean the Houthis? Because easier to talk about them as one rather than two.
When I say Nasrullah, it's because we think of these names because we're trying to kind of, you know, they're just a tribe. Nasrullah means, it's the name of their political party. Yeah. And that's what they call themselves. Like the National Liberation Front in Vietnam never called themselves the Viet Cong.
I think it's easier to use the most commonly used terms on these sorts of things. Well, otherwise, it just confuses listeners.
All right. Well,
this is the Houthis who were fighting the Saudi-sponsored so-called government of Yemen for many years. And we've had lots of reports. And in fact, maybe it's a good idea to invite Judith Brown back next week to talk about this because she's a Yemen expert. And this is basically a proxy war that was going on there for many years. And I suppose that, in a way, Yemen is saying, well, look, nobody else is doing anything about the Palestinian business. It's all going through the court in The Hague this week. So there's something happening there. We'll talk about that in a minute. But these people are thinking to themselves, well, we've got no other alternative, but we've got to do, someone's got to do something to aid the Palestinian in this genocide against them. 23,000 people now officially, and it's possibly more civilians that have been killed by the Israelis.
Yes, and the Houthis, if we want to call them that, they're basically saying when you stop the massacre in Gaza and allow humanitarian aid in, we will allow ships to go to Israel. And when you know, it's quid pro quo. And of course, the real pressure is being put on the British and the Americans. You tell your Israeli chums to stop. Everybody else has told them to stop. We've had UN Security Council resolutions, which were vetoed by the United States and Britain abstaining. What's very interesting to me about this coalition of the willing in the Red Sea is how thin it is. It's Britain and America. We've sent our naval power, the HMS Diamond, but nobody else has sent anything. The Australians have sent a few people. No doubt they're hanging around on the American ships. The Bahrainis, interestingly enough, the Saudis haven't sent anybody.
Exactly, no.
Because they don't dare.
The Saudis are actually pivoting away from the West towards China.
That's right, that's true.
And they're saying, well, hang on a minute, we've had this war where we're done with this Yemeni thing now. We would actually like to try and have peace with the Yemenis and get along with them. After all, we have a massive long land border with Yemen, and traditionally Yemen and Saudi Arabia is the same country.
Well, before the British...
Traditionally, yeah. Before the Sykes-Picot and all that.
Yeah. It's so thick. I mean, what's astonishing to me is that Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer presumably agrees with him.
Oh, he does, yeah. He came out straight away, so we support this.
Yes, yeah.
Of course.
Well, that
Starmer
puts Britain in a minority in Europe, for example. France, Italy, Spain, they'd said, we're not getting involved with this. We're just not getting involved with it. But we feel because the Americans and the Israelis are our best friends, that we're the only people who are prepared to stick our necks out and get involved.
Okay,
else wants to know.
Surely this is a perfectly reasonable tactic. The idea really is to hit the Western countries, particularly Israel, the UK, the USA, financially, without, the idea that denying the Red Sea to these ships is far less of a crime, if you want to call it a crime, than what's going on in Gaza.
Yes, and I think the way it's being spun in the West that they were trying to shut down all traffic up the Red Sea is wrong. They haven't been attacking, basically, is if you're not going to Israel, you can go through the Red Sea. But of course, the way it's been presented to British public opinion and US public opinion is, oh my God, this is going to affect us. We've got to intervene, otherwise our economy is going to be hit. And of course, what the bizarre thing about this is the idiocy of war is that now there is going to be a major war in the Red Sea. And of course, no commercial ships will go through a war zone. So that really will have the knock-on effect on the world economy, which they feared. It's not going to protect the world economy to have a war in the Red Sea. It's going to force the oil price up and probably crash the global economy. And if it escalates any further so that the Houthis end up hitting Saudi Arabian oil facilities, for example, then it really will crash the world economy. And we'll have to see who survives that. I tell you, who will survive that? The Russians. So they've got all the oil and gas they need.
So is there a certain amount of... this surely was predictable. Is it deliberate that they're creating... that the British have created this crisis in order to have an excuse to have a pop at Yemen, which they've actually been vicariously doing via Saudi Arabia for a decade or so?
Well, it is obviously perceived on the Yemeni side as more perfidious Albion and the United States and Israel. I mean, the slogan of the Nasrullah, the Houthi movement, is death to America, death to Israel, curse the Jews, victory to Islam. That is their slogan on their flag. And, of course, they have got massive popular support in Yemen, and popular support which has survived massive violence against their people. So they're not just mixing in. They feel the pain of the Palestinians because they themselves have been on the receiving end. All sorts of children have been killed by airstrikes in Yemen by the Saudis with British support. What happens in Britain is we think that we don't realise how we're perceived in the rest of the world. We are perceived as the world's bullies. That's how we're perceived. And I wouldn't want to be a British sailor on that ship, HMS Diamond, because if I was the Houthis, I would go directly for the British ship. There's only one, as far as I know, although I've heard that HMS Richmond is out there as well. We'll have to check. But of course, there's far more American ships, and it's only the British and the Americans who are there. But the British are the weakest link. If the Houthis sink that ship and kill a load of British sailors, that's going to bring a lot of questions home to here in Britain. Why are we doing this? Because nobody from France has been killed. Nobody from Italy has been killed. Nobody from Spain has been killed. All of the people that they lined up, they wanted all of these ships in there, yeah, to get blood on everybody's hands. But they all cried off apart from us. Because we are the attack dog for
it's
the United States.
It's funny because we're also
America.
Leading the charge in Ukraine, aren't we, with Rishi
That's
Sunak
right.
over there today.
That's right.
Another $2.5 billion, I think, isn't it? $15 billion yeah. or something now that the British have given to the Ukrainians?
That's right, and that's why we can't afford public transport.
Or is it
in
a loan?
Bristol.
Is it a loan or is
well,
it a
Well, in
gift?
Theory it's a loan, but it's never going to be repaid, so it might as well just be given to them, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've heard from the Houthis, and why don't we hear now from over in Ukraine from Rishi Sunak this morning?
Well, over the last month, we've seen a significant increase in the number of Houthi attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea. That's putting innocent lives at risk. It's disrupting the global economy, and it's also destabilizing the region. And in that time, we've also seen the single biggest attack on a Navy warship, a British Navy warship, that we've seen in decades. Now, it's clear that that type of behavior can't carry on. That's why we joined with allies in issuing very public condemnation of this behaviour, and it's why I made the decision with allies to take what I believe to be necessary, proportionate and targeted action against military targets to degrade and disrupt Houthi capability. We won't hesitate to protect lives and ensure the safety of commercial shipping. The types of things that we've targeted are launch sites for missiles and for drones. Initial indications are that those strikes have been successful. We'll continue to monitor the situation. But it's clear that this type of behaviour can't be met without a response. We need to send a strong signal that this breach of international law is wrong. We have acted in self-defence. It's incumbent now on the Houthis to stop carrying out these attacks, putting people's lives at risk and disrupting the global economy.
Yes, putting these people's lives at risk, not actually genociding them, and more important to the Goldman Sachs boy, is disrupting the global economy.
Well, that's right, but I mean, as I said earlier, what they have done, it will have very minimal impact on the Houthis. Don't forget, they've been under a continuous bombardment for many years by the Saudi Royal Air Force, and they've managed to survive all of that because what they've done, they've got their stuff is very decentralized. They don't have big bases. What they've been very good at is these very inexpensive drones. So the attack on HMS Diamond was all carried out by drones, and each missile that took down one of those drones cost millions of pounds. Again, more money being wasted that could be spent on public transport in Bristol. And then this is...
Yes, but they're working with their allies, as you just heard from the Prime Minister.
Yeah, and
there.
Who are our allies?
Allies. And I'm not sure we have allies. We have an ally in the United States.
Yeah, well, whether there
Who's
are...
Who's the other ally?
Australia. Australia, under its Labour government, have said that they've sent people, yeah, not a ship... Just some people that potential counterpart.
Swimmers?
No, presumably they've got Australian naval officers either on the British ships or the American ships. The Bahrainis are the only Middle East country.
You'd have thought the Middle East
countries would be all in favour of keeping
the
red...
Life jackets? I hope they have.
Well, they're going to need them, aren't they? Because the obvious thing that's going to happen now is the Houthis are going to be gunning to sink... I would, if I was them, I'd go for the British ship.
Yeah, of course.
It's a smaller, it's attackable, and they've got the capability to do things like that because warfare is changing.
I mean, just listen,
the Houthis
are
using these very, very cheap drones to overwhelm.
The Novochokatsk, Martin, was sunk over Christmas, wasn't it? A Russian ship. Yeah. So the temptation is they're saying, well, you've just sunk a Russian ship. Maybe someone's going to sink one of your oil.
Well, I mean, this is the point about what I'm making. British people want to go around the world. I mean, what Rishi Sunak's saying there, well, we've got to teach them a lesson. They haven't been taught a lesson. It's pointless. You won't have carried out. They've killed five people. Tragic for the families of those five people that they've killed, but it's not going to deter Anas Ruler that has taken, you know, they've taken thousands and thousands and thousands of casualties without backing down. They're not going to be intimidated by that. This policy that's being pursued by their government is very popular in Yemen. Have you seen the pictures of the demonstrations in Sana'a in support of the government? We've got millions and millions of people
in
the streets.
This is today, as a response to this, the Yemenis are now gunning for the Brits, as you heard there. The idea is that, in fact, we've been told that UK and the US must be ready to pay a heavy price after the attacks on Yemen. This is what the Ansarullah, the Houthis, have been saying today.
Well, that's right. And you might say, well, what can they do? I mean, we've got all this modern technology and this and that and the other. They are a very experienced fighting force. They've been fighting the high-tech Saudi armed forces and winning because they've got technical support from the Iranians. And they've got all this is the same thing that's happened in the Ukraine. Warfare has changed. If you think about it, having a load of ships in the Red Sea cruising up and down, it's basically like a duck shoot. Yeah? Outside the Red Sea.
It's not quite, is it? Because they did have an attack, as I said, earlier this week. I think it was maybe last weekend on the HMS Diamond. And the HMS Diamond released all these little expensive missiles and managed to survive it.
Yes, but it cost the Houthis maybe, you know, 30 grand to carry out that attack. And it cost the British 30 million to stop it. How many missiles have you got? You know, they're going to keep coming. And the only militarily sensible thing to do if you're going to attack Yemen is get all your ships out of the Red Sea and attack from the Arabian Gulf further away, where the Houthi stuff can't get at you. Eventually, they're going to want to withdraw from the Red Sea, past the Mamdeb Strait, but they won't be able to get out because it's a death trap.
In a way, it could be right, yeah. They could be trapped in there. I mean, they can probably get out. Well, surely the Egyptians will let them come out through the Suez Canal.
Not necessarily, because if you notice, nobody in the Middle East has joined this little coalition of the willing, apart from Bahrain, which, as I say, is a pro-Western dictatorship where the majority Shia population are opposed to what's going on. And, of course, Bahrain will be attacked. The Houthis have got the capability to attack Bahrain. They will attack it. And that's why the United Arab Emirates, the Saudis are calling for restraint. The Saudis are saying stop. Yeah? They're saying stop, British. Stop, Britain. Stop, stop. And they've been killing people from Yemen for years with British help. But they don't want... There's two reasons why they don't want to fight. As you say, they're changing their attitude. Secondly, of course, they're under massive pressure from the population of the Middle East as a whole and the Muslim community as a whole. The whole... of the Organization of Islamic States has backed this South African genocide allegation at The Hague. Yeah, the list of countries which are supporting this is massive. And the only people opposing this are the British, the Americans and the Israelis. Other European countries are not getting involved in this. There'll be no French sailors killed, no Italian sailors killed, no Spanish sailors killed. They're not joining in this one.
One of the most peculiar things is the Iranians have seized a tanker in retaliation for the United States stealing its oil. Apparently on this tanker, the Americans took over the tanker and took the oil from it. Well, a few months later, the Iranians have taken it back and taken the oil for themselves from this tanker. I'm not sure what the name of it is, but this was also in the Red Sea.
Yeah, well, the thing is, both the Red Sea and the Gulf of Persia, or the Gulf, whatever you want to call it, the Gulf.
It was in April last year. The Americans seized the Iranian oil, so-called because of they wanted some compensation from Iran, and they seized the tanker. Well, the Iranians have now done the same to them, back, you know, like for like.
All hostile...
In the Gulf of Oman, yeah, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, all hostile ships, either in the Gulf or in the Red Sea, are in a killing zone. if you were serious about going to war with Iran or with Yemen, you'd need to withdraw all those naval ships into the Indian Ocean and attack from far away so that the air defences of the other side are challenged. If you've got your ships right up close to the shore, then they are sitting targets. Yeah? The Iranians have got Chinese silkworm missiles. They sink aircraft carriers. Yeah? That's what will happen. If you bring your aircraft carrier anywhere near the land, it can be sunk. And the military thinking behind this was beggars belief. Well, there's no thought gone into it at all.
Do you want to just say something about the oil aspect of all of this? Now, if you're going to have tankers being seized, you could find the oil supplies to the West slowly drying up. Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations said in a statement to CNN that the seizure of this tanker in the Gulf of Oman was a lawful undertaking sanctioned by a court order and corresponds to the theft of Iran's very own oil. Adhering to the established legal procedure is the most prudent approach for resolution of this legal matter. United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations said earlier that a vessel in the Gulf of Oman had been boarded on Thursday by four armed people and had been diverted towards Iranian territorial waters. The ship's company security officer reported hearing unknown voices over the phone, after which communications with the vessel were lost.
Well, what's happening, both the Houthis and the Iranians are boiling a frog. They're not going to do anything which escalates things, because people don't want to fight unless they have to. So they're not going to go all out. They're trying to give the other side a golden bridge to back down. The obvious thing for the West to do is to say to the Israelis, you've got to stop this massacre in Gaza. They should have done it ages ago. That's what the world is demanding through the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly. And preventing that is the Israelis, the British and the Americans, the true axis of evil. But the scales are falling from the eyes of the world here. And Britain really isn't in a position to fight Russia, Iran and Yemen. And we will lose, and deservedly so, because we shouldn't be doing it.
Will this tactic work of hitting Britain, the United States and Israel in the pocket? This is what the Yemenis are trying to do here. Will it work? I mean, I can remember back in the 1990s when the IRA switched their campaign to blowing up big buildings in the City of London. John Major's government were very quick to get to the negotiating table and sign the Good Friday Agreement. So it does seem as if this whole idea of causing your enemy financial losses is more effective and successful than actually killing people.
It is, especially when you've got consumer societies in the West, and including in Israel, where people are used to having their standard of living. And suddenly when they find that they're going to have to live like church mice, they might decide that they don't want to fight anymore. Houthis have got nothing to lose. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. They've got nothing to lose. There's nothing to bomb either. It's been bombed to pieces. Every single possible target has been bombed years ago. And of course the Houthis have survived all of that because they don't have big bases that you can hit. Unlike the Sixth Fleet's base in Bahrain, which is a massive target. And the same, of course, the US has still got bases in Iraq and in Syria. The Iraqi government have told them you need to get out of Iraq.
In the meantime,
get out, otherwise you're going to be attacked. They are being attacked.
In British politics, the leader of the SNP, since the demise of the lovely, what was her name again? Nicola Sturgeon, that's right. Humza Yousaf has urged a recall of the Westminster Parliament over Yemen airstrikes.
Well, of course he has, and of course his wife's family are trapped inside Gaza. Now, if Keir Starmer thinks he's going to win votes in Scotland, did you see what happened at the Celtic Atletico Madrid match, where the Celtic fans all turned up festooned in Palestinian flags and waving Palestinian flags? And if Keir Starmer thinks he's going to win over SNP voters to the Labour Party by opposing a ceasefire that the SNP brought forward at Westminster Parliament, was supported by serious people in the Labour Party and outside the Labour Party like Jeremy Corbyn, who is incidentally in The Hague at the invitation of the South Africans to back up their lawsuit. He's not going to do it.
They've got one
MP in Scotland.
You could say this is being very cynically done late on a Thursday night, because they know that there's hardly anything happens in Parliament on a Friday, and it gives them 3 days without any proper political debate at all.
Well, and of course the thing is that even if we have a debate now, it's too late because they've started the war. Yeah? So that,
and they'll wait until this is out of the news before there's actually a discussion in Parliament.
Well, it's not going to come out of the news, is it? Because this is just the beginning. It's only that the decision to start the war is just the decision to start the war. The end of it is a long way away. And the obvious thing that may happen very quickly is the British ship is going to be sunk. That's what's going to happen. And then we've got to decide, are we going to build a load more ships to send to the Gulf to oppress one of the poorest countries in the world? Or are we just going to mind our own business?
Yeah, so the other big piece of news this week, of course, is the International Court of Justice. We've got a couple of reports on that now. The first day of the hearing in the genocide case against Israel.
Madam President.
Genocidal language, says Thembeka Nqukayethobi, comes from the very top.
Genocidal utterances are therefore not out in the fringes. They are embodied in state policy.
Palestinians have suffered 75 years of oppression, 57 years of occupation, and 16 years of a siege on Gaza. And for all that time,
Israel, for years, has regarded itself as beyond and above the law. As the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories explained in 2022, and I quote, the occupation by Israel has been conducted in profound defiance of international law and hundreds of United Nations resolutions with scant pushback from the international community.
So that was part of one of the Al Jazeera's reports, but also ITV were reporting on this too here in the UK.
In the Dutch city of The Hague, there is hope in a hotel room from a doctor who saw and who lived an autumn of despair in Gaza and is here for what he wants to be the winter that the bloodshed ends.
Maybe after all of these years, I can see that international law is going to bring justice to these victims.
We heard from Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita inside the hospitals of Gaza during his 43 days treating the wounded.
It was medieval, and we would be receiving hundreds of wounded. You just felt completely overwhelmed, and every day was worse than the day before. The difference between this and every other war that I've been to is the difference between a flood and a tsunami.
But he's here with more than just grim memories and anecdotes, but with a phone full of images and videos which help to tell the story. He shared them with Scotland Yard and now with ITV News. He was there when Al Ali Hospital was hit. A misfired rocket from a Palestinian group was blamed.
I looked into the courtyard where those families had been sitting earlier that day, and the cars were on fire, the ambulance was on fire. I just saw how many bodies were there. They were in the hundreds. And what was worse, close up, you could see that there were also bits of bodies. There was the forearm of a child. Why did you destroy?
But his view is that the Israeli military deliberately targeted Gaza's healthcare system and blocked the supply of medicine, part of a campaign of collective punishment. One allegation he makes, emphatically denied by Israel, is that this photograph of one of his patients indicates the illegal use of white phosphorus munitions, which put civilians at risk of serious and long-term injury.
And so what you see are circular kind of 50p coin-sized black holes, but when you cut them, you're cutting into the core of the body.
How did you come to the conclusion that it was white phosphorus?
It looked like a duck, it walked like a duck, and it talked like a duck, and I'd seen it before.
Is it possible that it was caused by, something else?
No.
Something other than white phosphorus?
No. It's very distinctive.
In Shifa, in addition to all of the human misery, there's now 120 children who are wounded and have no surviving family.
He says he eventually left Gaza because he no longer had the medicine to make any difference.
On one night at Al-Ahli Hospital, I did amputations on six children. One of them was a three-year-old boy who I amputated his arm and his leg. and he was the sole survivor of his family. So he has no one left.
So this is ITV's report, actually not directly from the International Court of Justice, part of the UN in The Hague, where the South Africans are putting this case, but really some talking to some of the eyewitnesses about the details surrounding it, Martin. So this is really a big test of the global legal system, one of the biggest since the end of the Second World War.
It is, and of course, I don't know what the politics of the International Court of Justice are like. It may be that they will dismiss this suit, but I think the South Africans have done a fantastic job to put it together. Their lawyers have done a really good job of putting it together.
Yeah, I'll put up a link to some of the actual testimony. I think it was on Wednesday when the court began, because it was particularly poignant listening to the South African accents talking about this apartheid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way that this actually is a genocide. The Israelis haven't signed up to many international treaties, but this is one of the ones that they signed up to really early on, wasn't it?
Yes, it is, but what will probably happen is that they will ignore it. But it will be more difficult for the British and the Americans to ignore it, because as the gentleman said there, I've given all this information to the British police force. Yeah? Because once the International Criminal, the International Court of Justice has ruled that it is genocide, then the police are empowered to make arrests.
I mean, is this ever going to happen, do you think? I mean, is it going to happen to Netanyahu or Sunak for supporting the genocide?
Well, that's why the British and the Americans are rather worried about what might happen here, because it's not just the South Africans, all of the Islamic countries, a load of countries in Latin America, loads of countries are backing this legal challenge. And, of course, what they're looking for is an injunction to stop what's happening. Nothing will happen. The Israelis will take no notice, but it does mean that every British bullet which goes through Akrotiri into Israel, once this, if they do declare it as genocide,
or special forces personnel,
yeah, all of those people become open to prosecution in international courts. And they need to think about that, because it really means that British generals and admirals can end up in prison. And the other alternative, of course, is not in prison, dead.
Well, I spoke earlier this week to, from Vancouver, Canada, Greg Felton, the author of a book, The Host and the Parasite, about the Israel lobby in the United States, about this International Court of Justice case.
One of the things that's being addressed there, for example, is this deprivation of food and water.
That's right. And there was a British MP got up, and he noted that Israel had turned the water back on. Now, that means originally Israel had turned it off, which is a crime against humanity. Israel, because it's so brazen and it thinks it has so much control over the world and how the world behaves, that it can effectively admit that it's a war criminal state and get away with it. It can indulge the carelessness of its own rhetoric. I mean, the Israelis are denying Palestinians electricity, water, food, shelter, everything that is considered a basic necessity for life. I mean, it's appalling. And yet nobody is doing anything about it. We try to ignore it. I mean, can you see just how much the world is bending over backwards not to condemn Israel? There are people making excuses for, oh, it's Hamas. Hamas did this, blah, blah, blah. Well, who cares? Israel is on record as engaging in disproportionate attacks against anyone who should attack Israel. This was admitted back in the last violence in Lebanon. An artillery colonel said what we did was monstrosity. It was monstrous. I mean, you had mass killing just because the Palestinians are in Lebanon. I mean, there was no need for anything that Israel did, nothing whatsoever. It has no regard for human life. It has no regard for the law. And right now it's so brazen, The only question is how long this is going to go on for before the world actually says, okay, Israel, enough is enough. We're going to send in our army. We're going to take you out. We're going to blow the living out of you, which should have happened decades ago. How long is this going to go on for? I mean, the public around the world is apoplectic at the genocide being committed in Palestine. But no one is doing anything. We're just watching it and saying, tut, tut, isn't this awful?
Well, no, that's not quite the case, because the Yemenis have been denying the Red Sea to Western trade. This is sending the big corporations. Well, I mean, Lloyd's of London are looking at this very closely, and other big insurance companies. And these ships are now coming from India, China, etc. to Europe, are having to make an extra 6,000-mile trip, which is costing a few bob.
Yeah, well, that doesn't really make much difference. It's not exactly a war crime, is it? I mean, who cares? The Yemenis are doing what they can to make life difficult for Western governments.
Yeah, so just talking a little bit about Yemen at the end there, Martin, it's 2,000 ships so far have had to divert around the Cape of Good Hope, and that is an extra 6,000 miles each way.
Yeah, I think the main reason why they've had to go the long way round is because of the insurance companies. And, you know, the insurance just becomes ridiculous. And, of course, what they've done now is they've made the insurance companies are not going to touch anybody going through the Red Sea with a barge pole now. And they really, what they've done is they've actually crashed the world economy. Because in actual fact, if they just let the Houthis carry on attacking Israeli ships which are going to Israel, then the world economy could have carried on functioning.
Do you want to just give us your take on why it is that America and Britain are backing the Israelis in this genocide?
Well, there are two things. One is that they've got their own imperialist interests in the Middle East. They've wanted the Americans and the British,
yeah.
And the British as the junior partners, obviously, but we used to be the senior partners back in the day. You know, all of these countries used to be a part of our empire, remember? Yemen, Palestine, it was all part of the British Empire. Iraq, it was all part of our great, glorious empire.
It seems
empire.
As the country itself becomes more and more of a basket case, financially, economically and politically. So more and more interest seems to be being taken by our so-called leaders about what goes on abroad.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's it's part of the DNA of our ruling class that they feel that they have to stick their finger into all of these things. It makes them feel important to be hanging around with the Yanks, you know, and helping them out. I mean, in the Ukraine, the Russians definitely regard the British as the most belligerent of all the people that they're dealing with. And it's part of the internal culture of our country. And people like Keir Starmer, going along to rubber stamp all of this at the, you know, on the Zoom meeting the other day. Meanwhile, of course, the former leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, is in The Hague with his South African comrades. And of course, that's the big split in this country between the people who are part of the imperialist past of the country and the people like Jeremy Corbyn and myself and yourself, who are part of our non-imperialist future.
Yep, well, I'd agree with that. But look, Greg Felton also, I asked him about this. What is it, what kind of belief system? I want to believe is my T-shirt, but what belief system is it that brings the Americans, the Israelis and the British leadership together to conduct this genocide in Gaza?
The religion in the world today that dominates everybody's thinking to one degree or another, whether overtly or passively, is Holocaustianity. You can't criticize the official Zionist propaganda about World War II. And because you can't do that, Israel, which essentially dominates so much of the world, dictates national policy. Canada is, for example, is so afraid of the Israel lobby that the government would never stand in its way. It's all Trudeau can do, for example, is to say we'll abstain on a vote that clearly requires a positive vote. And that abstention is proof that Canada is afraid to challenge the Israelis. The United States is afraid to challenge the Israelis. You watch the spokesman for Biden get up and answer questions. It's just embarrassing. He's being put journalists are putting really good questions to him, and all he can do is mutter blithering nonsense about Hamas starting it, or that we're trying to ensure that civilians aren't harmed, or such things like this. I mean, it's embarrassing.
Okay, so where is this heading in Gaza? It's quite definitely and obviously a genocide, but is it going to end anytime soon? And if it doesn't, where is it heading?
I don't know. I'd like to think it does end soon, but you see, without an army, without an air force to coerce Israel into surrendering Gaza, I don't know how long this will go on. Israel has to be destroyed. It must be bombed into submission, or the Jews in Israel have to stage a revolution against the Zionist entity. There has to be a creation of a democratic state that incorporates Palestine and whatever Jews happen to be there, with compensation for the Arabs, as promised, as Israel promised in the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194, which formed the basis of its admission to the UN. And of course, Israel is an illegitimate member of the UN and needs to be expelled forthwith. And I brought this to the attention of a Irish MP, and I'm hoping it was received with thanks, and I'm hoping that something is mentioned in the dial, Irish Parliament, to get on record that Israel is an illegitimate member of the UN. But as far as goes, I don't know how long it'll go. I mean, I think that the Palestinians will win in the International Court of Justice, but because the United States is such a sycophantic stooge of Israel, it will sabotage any enforcement. I don't see, this is why it's important to have a military. It's important to have the will to resort to force of arms to do something to defend your interests. And right now we have a lot of peace. The idea of people talking peace is disastrous. I mean, the one thing that the suffering in Palestine is doing is it's pointing out to the world that Israel was never legitimate to begin with. And that illegitimacy must be kept front and center. I don't know how long the world is going to have protest marches, how cities like Barcelona, Berlin, Paris, London, New York. These are countries that have had huge public demonstrations of support for Palestine. I hope we can keep this up, but I hope fatigue does not set in, which I think is what Israel is counting on. They're prepared to put up with abuse and attacks because of their genocide, but they know eventually people will tire and they will forget, and it will be back to murder as usual.
Well, I largely agree with that, actually. I think ultimately that there are no non-military solutions to this. But I think the Israelis have overplayed their hand militarily. They're not actually winning in Gaza. Hamas's military infrastructure is still intact. They can't beat Hezbollah in Lebanon. They were defeated in 2006, and if they try and take on Hezbollah, they will lose again. We've got the Houthis wading in. And don't forget, there's a Syrian Arab army waiting on the other side of the Golan Heights. They've taken a hell of a battering in recent years, but they're still there. And they're very experienced because they've had all the fighting. The same is true of Hezbollah. They lost thousands of people in Syria.
But anyway, Greg Felton, that was, you heard there, from Vancouver, writer,
and of course, the former Russian Air
journalist, and he's saying also that this has ended the myth about Israel being in any way a kind of legitimate democratic nation.
I agree with that. The obvious way to punish the Israelis is to say, we're not going to recognise your state, which is exactly what the Iranian leadership has been saying for years. You know, this is not a legitimate state. And they say, yes, you just want to genocide us. No. What's happened to Algérie Française, where French settlers have been dominating Algeria for over 123 years, and they fought a war against the FLN to retain power in Algeria. Over a million people died in that war, so it was a bigger war than what we're seeing now, and at the end of it, virtually all of those French settlers had to go.
Well, didn't we see...
And that will happen to the Israelis.
Something like this going on in Northern Ireland, actually, and the British settlers, or we could say absentee landowners, being booted out in the create the Irish Free State back in the First World War.
Well, it's slightly different because...
No, I know, yeah, but...
Because obviously
it's the same principle.
Each of these conflicts have unique
features. Isn't
it the
same principle?
It is the same principle. The same principle is true. I mean, basically, all of the Protestant community in Northern Ireland was put in there by Cromwell and other British leaders in order to repress the Irish. That's why they were put there. That land used to belong to Irish Catholics.
One of the reasons,
and it was taken off them.
One of the chief lawyers, actually, over in The Hague, acting for the South African government, is Irish.
Well, there we are. I mean, the Irish position on this has been consistent from the beginning across the political spectrum, including the Alliance Party in Northern Ireland, which are largely Protestant. They came out in favour of a ceasefire straight away, because people in Northern Ireland know that ceasefires are good. They're not bad, ceasefires are good. And why can't we have one? We've had ceasefires in the past between Hamas and Israel. We've had them. And when they say we can't have them, why not?
Another excellent point being made by Greg Felton there is this. He's saying to this about the Palestinians. Obviously, they've been divided into the West Bank and Gaza into these concentration camps. But he's saying it's absolutely crucial that everybody, particularly these people, have got armed forces and they have the right to self-defence.
Well, they have the right to self-defence and they have got
they've
armed
got
forces.
The right, yeah.
Yeah, they have got armed
and so
forces.
Hamas has not been
eliminated.
This is a trick, isn't it? This whole business of calling them terrorists. They're actually perfectly legitimately able, or should be allowed, and legally are allowed to defend themselves. The idea that you're saying that Hamas is a terrorist organisation, which is proscribed by Britain, means that the British just are ignoring the international rule of law.
Well, they're also ignoring the fact, don't forget, Hamas people fought on the side of the Free Syrian Army to overthrow Assad. And when they were doing that, David Cameron and all these politicians in Britain were cheering them on to overthrow the evil Assad. And that was all part of the Arab Spring. Remember the Arab Spring, Tony? When the people rose up against their dictators, their terrible dictators, and then it turned into an armed struggle in Libya, which we got involved in, and an armed struggle in Syria. And we were going, yes, armed struggle for democracy. And of course, Hamas was involved in that. And when they were doing that, they were in the right side. Hamas and Hezbollah were fighting each other in Syria. Now they're on the same side. Now, what's the difference between Hamas fighting the Syrian Arab army and Hamas fighting the Israeli army? It's the same Hamas. When they were fighting the Syrian Arab army, they were freedom fighters. Now they're fighting the Israelis, they're terrorists. And in actual fact, as you say, they're not in fact terrorists. They've got the right to defend themselves. Yeah. If the Germans had occupied Britain and there had been an uprising against it by armed forces, stay behind armed forces, and the Germans had responded by carrying out mass massacres of people in Liverpool and Birmingham and so on, we would have been absolutely justified to carry on fighting them, wouldn't
we? We certainly would. And in international law, they are, the Palestinians are justified in resisting the occupation there. Anyway, so let's go back into time a little bit, because I think it's important to understand how we got where we are. In fact, I can remember back in 1990, in the first Gulf War, listening avidly to the brand new Radio 5 Live on Medium Wave and hearing some excellent analysis by BBC correspondents there about the history of what had been going on in the Middle East. And it was a real eye-opener. So let's have a look now. Let's go back to 1978 with a couple of clips from an interview with a certain Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, and here he is talking about Palestinian human rights.
The Palestinians in the West Bank are going to be offered the full human rights, the full civil rights, as there are no Arabs are offered in the Middle East. No Arabs whatsoever have any full human rights or the right to vote for their own government. Those Arabs who lived in Israel in the pre-67 boundaries are the only Arabs in the Middle East who offer that right, and I'm all in favor of having the same Arabs living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip being offered such a right in the final peace agreement.
Can we have peace in the Middle East?
Very briefly, please.
Yes, I sincerely hope so. Look, I'm 28 years old. I've had to defend my country in two wars and in many battles. Nobody wants peace more than Israel. But the stumbling block to the road for peace is this demand for a PLO state, which will mean more war, which will mean more violence in the Middle East, And I think, I sincerely believe, if this demand is abandoned, we can have real and genuine peace.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fagan. Now we'll go to Mr. Adame. Mr. Adame, some questions for Mr. Natar.
Yeah, so now we're going to hear some of the questions from the Arab side. That was the US press asking Netanyahu back in 1978, a young 28-year-old Netanyahu. The Arab questions were a little bit tougher.
Mr. Natai, you've told everyone that the Palestinians on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will enjoy full human rights. Could you tell me how that's compatible with the presence of Israeli forces in their midst?
Well, the Arabs living now under... The Arabs who lived in Israel, 400,000 of them, 400,000, between 1948 and 67, as I said earlier, certainly enjoy full human rights. And as I
I'm
said, they're
talking
the only
about
ones.
The Arabs in Israel. I'm talking about the Arabs on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
If you let me, I'll answer your question, Mr. Ajami, please. The Arabs living in Israel are the only ones who are entitled to vote for their governments, the only ones who have representative in a parliament in the entire Middle East. Now, it's true that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are now undergoing a period of transition. In fact, no Arab government has been willing to negotiate so far about this period of transition. And I think that when this transition, when negotiation period is ended, there is no reason why under either Jordanian citizenship or Israeli citizenship, these Arabs will not have the full human rights, the right to vote for their representatives, as the Arabs in Israel do, as hopefully all the Arabs in the Middle East will do someday.
Mr. Natai, does the state of Israel itself accept that the people on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have the right to vote on whatever future they choose?
Well, Mr. Ajami, I just outlined that in the event that this negotiation process will continue, I'm sure that what we're talking about is, in fact, eventual citizenship of some kind, either Jordanian or Israeli or in any other arrangement, in which these people will certainly vote.
Mr. Natai, you've given yourself the right to determine that you are an Israeli, but you've also given yourself the right to negate the other entity, which I think is not somehow consistent with global practice at this time, is it?
Mr. Ajami, I have never rejected another entity, nor have I ever declared my intent to destroy it, least of all the Palestinian Arabs, who I fervently want to live in peace with. All I'm saying is that it is the Palestinian Arabs themselves, their leaders, Arafat, Mohsen, who Morris Abrams quoted earlier, Farouk Kaddoumi, the number two man in the PLO, these are the ones who say they are part of the Arab nation. These are the ones who say they already have a Palestinian state. There is no right to establish a second one on my doorstep, which will threaten my existence. There is no right whatsoever.
Okay, Mr. Natai, you seem like a very patriotic Israeli. Does not the fact of Israeli dependence upon the U.S. in order to maintain its occupation on the West Bank and the Gaza, does this not trouble you at all?
Mr. Ajami, you asked me as a patriotic Israeli, and I'll answer as someone who has fought in the Middle East. One of the things that I think is unique about Israel, in terms of all America's allies, is that it is perhaps the only one who has taken care of itself so far. And I would think that America, in fact, it's not a one-way street, Israel taking from the United States. Israel is giving the United States an extraordinary bargain in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It's the one stable democratic ally which the United States can count on.
Well, he's changed his tune, hasn't he, quite significantly since then. He's now trying to appease his own right wing by saying, I've never been in favour of a Palestinian state, and the Palestinians need to be destroyed like the Amalekites in the Bible.
Wasn't he just buying time back? I mean, this is 45 years ago. That's an incredibly long time.
Yes, I mean, don't forget that, as Sitting Bull said, they made us many promises, but they never kept but one. They promised to take our land, and they took it. And, of course, they will go through phases of pretending that they're prepared to negotiate, while speaking on the other side of their mouth, telling their supporters, no, we're never going to negotiate. We're just having. I mean, Netanyahu at one stage was in a meeting with people who said, we control the United States. We can get them to do what we want. You don't have to worry about them. They will do as we say.
And do you remember Obama? I think it was a UN meeting. He was overheard. He had his microphone on, and he didn't realise he was starting muttering about Netanyahu. He said, that guy phones me up almost every day. I find him really annoying. This is the way the Israelis seem to think that they do own the United States. I don't quite understand how that works.
Well, the way it works is because the United States system is incredibly corrupt, first-past-the-post system, and they buy the politics. politicians. Don't forget that the United States taxpayer subsidizes the Israeli state to the tune of billions of dollars every year. And then that money is then siphoned back into the United States to buy the politicians to keep the scam going. That's what's happened.
Yeah, it's like a kind of mafia state, impossible to break. Really.
Yeah, it is a mafia. And don't forget, a lot of these, a lot of the Russian mafia are Israeli, and they all live in Israel as well.
Of course,
as I mentioned earlier, the Russian armed forces are in Syria. The Russians are being very cautious. They've called a UN Security Council meeting, I think, for tomorrow, and they're going to say, you know, Britain and America, you've got to back off here in the Red Sea. But of course, that will be ignored.
And back in December 2007, I spoke to a guy called Bill Nash. He was in the British Army over in Palestine during World War II. So we're going to go even back, just after World War II, 1947 and 1948. And he was one of those British soldiers that was withdrawn once the Israeli state was created in 1948. But he had all sorts of interesting things. Tell me about this. And I'll put, like the Greg Felton interview, the full interview with Bill Nash up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's hear now from him about the King David Hotel explosion by the Israeli Jewish terrorists that had taken place against the British, which was one of the British headquarters in Israel, which was just blown up by these Israeli terrorists just before he actually was posted out there.
Yes, that was the first big thing that happened. I mean, it was just starting then, and security was very lax in the hotel, and a handful of them just came and went into the basement and placed a bomb there and set it off. It was a very easy job to do. They were surprised. And that started off, and then from then on it was rather much tighter. I was stationed in Jerusalem just after that, and I'd been to the officers' club down in town Jerusalem. I was living in Allenby Barracks, and I thought the officers' club would be a very nice place to live. There was a beautiful Jewish girl there on the reception. And I thought this could be very pleasant, so I planned to move in on the Friday. On the Thursday, it was blown up, and I was on the court of inquiry. And it's quite amazing, the people that escaped, people standing on the first floor above the bomb, two officers talking, and the explosion went between them, and they were both deafened, but perfectly all right, whereas people sleeping on the second floor were killed. And two officers on the roof who were sunbathing came down with the roof and just walked off the ruins perfectly, not a scratch on them. But the poor Jewish girl, I mean, there was a picture of her being carried out in a stretcher with her head off, and two soldiers who were carrying her were vomiting to one side. It's appalling business.
So that was which attack again?
That was on the Officers' Club after the King David. But it was going on all the time after that. It was just a constant thing.
Wasn't there really an attempt, though, by the British to make sure that there was some form of power sharing between the Jewish and the Arabs?
It wasn't a question. I don't think there was any problem about that. I think the Jews were being quite sensible in that respect. They said, look, if we get this, you have the same vote as anybody else to the Arabs resident there. And they'd been living side by side for a couple of thousand years with no problems. The problem started when the political wing of the Jewish people, the Zionists, decided that they wanted a state of their own, and they decided on that spot. And of course, you get the people whipped up. I mean, if you were Jewish, of course, having had what you've had in Europe, we can't go on like we were. We have to have our own country to defend our interests. And this was the site selected for historic reasons, and so they were dedicated to it, and nothing we could do about it. They said to the Arabs, we would give you one vote each, but the Arabs decided no, they didn't want that. Because what I used to say to the servants in the mess and so on, you know, well, you chaps would go along with this. I didn't know much about it, only 19. But I said, they've done wonders in the parts of the country that they're occupying. It was green, they were growing fertile land, they were growing oranges, it was becoming little bits of prosperity. And I said, well, go along with these people, you'll do very well. They said, no, British, leave Palestine, all Jews dead 1 week, and they'd just cross their throats, you know. I said, what could you do? Madness on both sides. But
so to tell us about when the British finally pulled out, can you describe that?
Well, that went very quietly. We just, all our stores were pushed into Haifa, the port there, and we kept one brigade there. And it took us about a month to clear it. It was very, we took an interest in us then because we were out of it. We were no longer in the country, and we just had this little port. And neither side took an interest on us, but there was still a little bit of trouble between them. And the Jews notified the brigade command at one stage that they were going to clear the Arab, the old city, the Arab city, part of the city, out the next morning because they'd been having trouble with them. And so the brigade command to make a quick decision as to what to do, try and get in between or what. But we decided it was futile, so we left it. And by 6:30 the next morning, they were all gone, out, floating out to sea in little boats. And it was quiet after that. They blew a flour mill up after that, and they were walking around looking as though they just dumped out of a sack of flour, like ghosts, for about a week. But after that, there was nothing much of interest. The odd shot fired, but nothing.
So that's Bill Nash there, speaking to me back in 2007. He was in the British Army stationed over in Palestine, Martin. Interesting, I think, to hear that the British were sort of, once this decision had been made at the UN, it was just, they were very glad to actually get out of it. One of the other things in that interview, I'll put a full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, he says is that in the negotiations that the British were trying to have between the Jews and the Arabs, that every Arab that was ever put forward to represent the Arab population in these British mediation, negotiations, would be very swiftly killed.
Yes, and also they killed the moderates within their own community. That was the strategy of the Irgun and of the Haganah. There's a book that I read not that long ago, quite a recent book called State of Terror, which is about the creation of the State of Israel, and it very much relies upon the records from the British military authorities. He's gone through all of the special branch files and all the rest of it. And from the very beginning, the Israeli right wing were determined to have an ethnically pure state, and they were going to drive the Palestinians out. And of course, the British withdrew because the Americans and the Soviet Union decided that they were prepared to. I mean, Ernie Bevin, who was originally from Bristol, was opposed to the creation of an Israeli state because he was saying they can't have a state because it's going to cause problems, and second of all, they shouldn't have a state because of the way they've gone about getting it through this indiscriminate terror. Because if people get a state through indiscriminate terror, everybody else is going to think they can get
it. It was not indiscriminate, surely. They weren't killing themselves, were they?
No, it was indiscriminate in the sense that they killed lots of Palestinian civilians.
Yeah.
The British Army, remember, there.
Very much sectarian.
Yes, it was. Yeah. They killed lots of Palestinian civilians. They directly killed them in order to put the fear of God into them. And in actual fact, the Irgun ended up running the Israeli state. None of them were ever punished, and they got their state. And of course, Hamas have learned that lesson. You've got to be, if you want to build a state, you've got to be absolutely ruthless. Don't let anybody get in your way, and make sure you make it stick. They've learned the lesson well. And if the Israelis, I think, have overestimated their military power. They think that because they've got support from the Americans that nobody can beat them. They're wrong. The Americans are beatable. They're being beaten in the Ukraine right now.
One of the aspects of this really must almost every week mention is the killing of journalists, the deliberate targeting of journalists by the Israelis. And on Al Jazeera this week, we had a fascinating debate, discussion about this with some terrific people involved in it, including... I'll put obviously a link up to the whole thing up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Great discussion about the deliberate targeting of journalists, and they call it What International Solidarity Exists for Journalists in Gaza. That's Inside Story. But let's have a listen to a clip from that now.
We would have nothing if it weren't for those. A lot of the documentation work is now being taken on by journalists because we've also lost so many aid workers and others who often take on some of this documentation work too. So we are entirely reliant on these journalists to be our eyes and ears, to bring us the information and the images of what's happening. And it's unimaginable to think that they can still be doing this 3 months into the war. If you think that quite often in war correspondents will be cycled in and out. They might go in for a month and come out for a month if they're being brought in by international organisations. These people are day in, day out. Your colleague, Wael Dakhdour, I saw this morning up and reporting. I cannot even imagine what it takes to have seen so many of your family members killed, your son also a journalist killed, and to be able to get up the next day and report, because it is that important to bring the information, to make the world see what is happening in Gaza, and we are reliant on journalists to do that work.
Ali, how much longer can journalists in Gaza keep doing this work? Many of the most prominent of them have already been forced to take a step back due to concerns that they risk their own and their families' safety.
I'm amazed at how they've continued doing what they do for this long. And that goes for everyone in Gaza, whether it's medical workers, whether it's simply people trying to care for their loved ones, to get them food every day. I mean, think about how exhausting this is for those of us who are not in Gaza, but who are following it closely, who have friends and loved ones there. And then multiply that by a million for those who are in Gaza, who have no way, there's no respite. There's no way to take a break. There's no way to take a break from the hunger, from the cold, from the fear, from the fear for your loved ones who you can't see because either you're separated from them geographically, or as Hind al-Khudri said, journalists are reluctant to be with their families because they're afraid they will be targeted and their families will be killed along with them. Imagine the dedication it takes to be away from your parents or your grandparents or your children or your partner, just because you're dedicated to bringing the news to the world and feeling you have that duty to your people and humanity to sacrifice yourself and your own well-being and even that of your family in order to make sure that the world can see this genocide and can never say we didn't know. And for all those hypocrites who lecture us again and again, never again, never again, who are supporting this genocide, the European governments and the United States, the ones that cry the loudest about never again and learning the lessons of history, are the ones openly perpetrating another Holocaust in Gaza. And they are also trying to murder the world's eyes and ears who are reporting on this genocide, who are the journalists. I don't have enough words to convey my anger, my disgust, and my horror at what we're witnessing in real time.
We must end our discussion. Many thanks indeed to you all, Tim Dawson, Ali Abu Nima, and Jody Ginsberg.
Well, any nerds amongst you will notice the mention of Tim Dawson, who's one of the senior officials at the National Union of Journalists, also involved in that discussion. So, as I say, I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I think Al Jazeera is doing a terrific job, actually, in making sure, even if there are far less journalists in Gaza than many of the media companies around the world, and certainly the viewers and listeners would like, because of the way that the Israelis have been killing them, and ensuring that it's very, very difficult for any journalist to accept, maybe to be parachuted in there, they can then get along with their war crimes and their genocide without it being witnessed. This is quite an almost unprecedented aspect of this particular genocide, is the very, very deliberate efforts to make sure that no one sees it.
Except that it's not working, because people are brave enough to take those risks. The other thing, of course, is there are lickspittle yellow journalists like CNN who allow their reports from Tel Aviv to be censored by the Israeli Defense Forces before they come out. In other words, they're basically just handing out PR for the Israeli occupation forces. Let's call them by their real name. And I think the other thing that's made it very difficult for them to control is the existence of social media. People can actually film their families being killed on their phones, and they can upload it as long as the electricity's working.
I mean,
and
how
everybody
long is Al Jazeera?
See it.
I mean, do you think the British authorities are going to do to Al Jazeera what they did to RT?
Well, but they've already done it to Al Jazeera. I mean, but the Al Jazeera reporter one Al Jazeera reporter in Gaza, he came home to find that his family had been deliberately targeted.
No, I'm talking
targeted.
About taking them off the satellites and taking them off the air.
Well, they may do that, but that will be showing that they can't.
They've
it.
Already showed that with Russia, haven't
yes,
they?
Yes, they have, but that means that they're basically saying to the Qataris, who are our allies, supposedly, you know, they're the reasonable, you know, Gulf monarchies that we're supposed to be thinking of as the moderates.
Collaborators with Hamas.
Yes, those people. But you, if you do that, you're sending a clear message to everybody that you can't...
Yeah, but you don't know what you don't know, these things going on a long, long way away.
Well, I think the problem is the damage is already done. If they close down Al Jazeera, the Arab world will go bonkers.
Anyway, I'm reminded of David Halpin quite often. I missed a call from him this morning. Sorry, David, but David Halpin is the doctor that blew the whistle on assassination of Dr. David Kelly, which was supposed to have been a suicide back in 2003 on the Iraq War. And he's often talking about these Armageddonists. Now, it does. I mean, Martin, maybe you can say something about this. This whole idea. Of the possibility of a massive conflagration centred around the Middle East. I mean, it does seem as if that's looming large right now, a kind of World War III Armageddon.
Well, I mean, that's the obvious danger that we're facing here. This isn't just about Gaza. There has been the ethnic cleansing of the Armenians from Nagorno-Karabakh. There's the ongoing war in Syria, which we've been directly involved in, which has killed thousands and thousands of people and displaced millions. There's the destruction of Libya, the destruction of Iraq. And, of course, in Iraq itself, the elected Iraqi government are calling for US forces to leave because they've been killing people inside Iraq who they think are to blame for attacks on their bases, which shouldn't be there because they were told to get out of after the massacre.
A lot of this is focused on this clash between these fake Jews, the Zionists, and the Islamic and the rest of the Christian and even the atheist population in Palestine seems to be the potential centre for a world war. Particularly if the Chinese get dragged in, the Russians get dragged in, other nations get dragged in, it's definitely on the cards. And you know, just a little sinking of a British ship, for example, could be another ratchet on the way to that wider war. But I thought we'd have a listen now because there was a good piece came out over the Christmas break about accelerationism, and these are the Armageddonists, basically. Why some billionaires are actively trying to destroy the world? A good question. And here's a clip from that now. I'll put the longer version up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk.
It's Nick Land's writings that are considered foundational to right-wing accelerationism, or RX. Both sides envision a post-capitalist future and a technological singularity. LX is concerned with producing more equal, more just world after the revolution, and they believe that technology is the key to improving the human condition. Which isn't really that far off from the original meaning from Lords of Light, if you think about it. Nick Land, meanwhile, has gone further to the right. Since 2013, he's actually been associated with a far-right neo-reaction movement, also known as NRX. NRX was spun out of the blog of a software engineer named Curtis Yarvin, who posts under the name Mencius Moldbug. They're anti-democracy and pro-authoritarian, to the point that some of the NRXers actually criticized Donald Trump for not declaring himself king. Yes, the collapse of Western civilization, brought to you by K-Punk and Mencius Moldbug. So obviously there's some dangerous ideas that we're walking into here, but it helps to keep in mind that at least most of these people think that they're actually getting us closer to a better world. And that's based on the idea of the four turnings. I've been reading this book lately. Not for this video, I've had this for a while. I'm about halfway through it, but I feel like I can talk somewhat coherently about it. It's called The Fourth Turning Is Here, and it's written by Neil Howe, and it's a follow-up to a previous book from 1997 called The Fourth Turning by Howe and the historian William Strauss. Now, seeing me hold up this book is causing every single one of you guys to have at least one of three reactions right now.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, finally. Yeah, just do this.
This is a polarizing book. To some people, this is gospel. To others, it's garbage on par with the writings of Nostradamus. But to those who are unfamiliar, the basic gist goes like this. The theory of the four turnings, which is also called Strauss-Howe generational theory, basically makes the argument that civilization is cyclical, that it operates in cycles. This mostly applies to Western civilization, but very specifically to the United States. These cycles last for about 80 to 90 years, roughly the length of a long human lifespan, and they've named these cycles saeculum, which is an old Roman word that has a similar meaning. And each of these cycles is made up of what they call four turnings, kind of like seasons of a civilization. They name those seasons the high, the awakening, the unraveling, and the crisis. And each of these lasts about 20 or 30 years. It works like this. Each saeculum is defined by a major crisis point, a world-changing event that upturns established institutions and is usually punctuated by a massive war, a total war in their parlance. This is the last turning in a saeculum, so they call this the fourth turning. Many proponents of this theory consider World War II to be the most recent crisis era. Following the crisis is the high period, the first turning of a new saeculum. This is when peace returns and society's on an upswing. It's an optimistic era. Social cohesion is high, community involvement is strong, and a collective vision for the future is widely shared. In the U.S., the post-war years of the 50s and the early 60s were our most recent high period, which is why it's often romanticized as the good old days. When people say they want to make things great again, this is the time period they're often talking about. The second turning is called the Awakening. This is when the strict social conformity of the high period starts to wane and people start to search for more individual autonomy, often through spirituality and cultural rebellion. Whereas the crisis years are marked by political upheaval, the awakening years are marked by cultural upheaval. This is analogous to the consciousness revolution of the hippies in the 60s and 70s. The third turning is the unraveling period. This is basically the opposite of the high period, where collective energy is at its lowest point and individualism is at its height. It's marked by a lack of trust in government and institutions, and as a result, inequality begins to grow and divisions form in society. Divisions that eventually lead back to a crisis period, bringing a close to the saeculum, and the cycle starts all over again. Now, the reason this works, and the reason it's called generational theory, is because each generation is kind of shaped by the turning that they're brought up in. And as they get older, they seek to change the world away from the values that were imposed on them when they were young. You know, everybody wants to undo the problems that they inherited. So there's an idea, or a saying, I don't think it's really tied to this book or anything, but it's that, you know, a generation that goes through war and experiences all the terrible things that war, you know, brings about, you know, they come out of it wanting to never see war again. And then their children grow up having heard all the stories about how terrible things were, what their parents went through, and they actually see some of the scars, physical and emotional, that they carry with them. So they avoid war as they get older. But it's the grandkids that come along, and of course they want to rebel against their parents, and they begin to romanticize the purpose and the greatness of their grandparents' generation. And then war and conflict become attractive again. Anyway, according to this theory, the different generations fit into different archetypes based on the turning that they were brought up in. And these archetypes are prophets, nomads, heroes, and artists. And as time progresses through the different turnings, each generational archetype has a different role to play in those turnings.
Yeah, not quite sure of the chap's name, but I'll put a link up to that and I'll find it by later on. This is accelerationism. This is also an interesting theory, isn't it, Martin, about the sort of multi-generational, well, it's what he calls the four turnings, but every 80 to 90 years is a kind of cycle from one massive world war maybe to the next one coming up any time now.
You don't really need a fancy theory to fear the possibility of World War III.
Now, he's saying it's a cycle, and it's also looking at the psychology of generations brought up at different points
in
that cycle.
Yeah, well, I can hear what they're saying, but what I would say from my social sciences point of view is it's easy to have theories about things, but in actual fact, each cycle is unique, yeah? I mean, one unique feature of this cycle is the existence of nuclear weapons. If we hadn't had nuclear weapons, World War III would undoubtedly already have broken out. But that doesn't mean it won't break out. And, of course, the other thing that's not mentioned in that is you've got the progression of, Christian fundamentalist Zionism in the United States, which is a big force. That's one of the things that's really driving all of this, because they believe in Armageddon, in destroying the world, because they think the rapture is going to rescue them and they're all going to live happily ever after in some heaven somewhere on the other side of the universe.
The guy's name is Joe Scott, by the way, and thanks to Dave, sound engineer Dave Bazanko here, for sending me that. Bit fascinating. Anything to do with accelerationism, folks, very, very interesting. If you come across a good one, do send it to me. And still trying to pursue at some point. It'd be nice to get an interview with Nick, my old schoolmate from Langley Park back in the 1970s. And I promise I won't call you Nick the Nazi, Nick, but we will have I would love to have a fascinating conversation, because I always felt, always feel that even though Nick and I were and have developed into very different directions, that there was still a lot we had in common too. Probably something like the love of the Stranglers, for example. Anyway, look, special interview with Stephen Sizer now, taking a slightly different tack, which is his view of what's going on in the Middle East. And this is part of a nearly hour-long interview with Muslim Channel over in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, that he did just before Christmas. And I put up online as a kind of Christmas special by Stephen Sizer. He's the Church of England vicar from Virginia Water in Surrey. That was told by Archbishop Welby that he wasn't allowed to talk about the Middle East in his sermons, because he shared some article, which Martin and I rather love, on his Facebook page, entitled 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World, which was from Wikispooks. So Let's have a listen to Stephen Sizer's take. And as I say, keep saying tonight, too much maybe, that the I'll put a link to the full interview and the full discussion, which is about an hour long, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk.
In Scripture, God has given promises and predicted things would happen because God is outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have is interpreting those prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
And the temptation throughout history has always been what we would call chronological arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
The belief that our generation is the one that the Bible is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We are the most important ones, and therefore the Bible is coming true in our day.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the past and not in the future. We're blinkered.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to see as we look back in history to how those promises or those prophecies were misunderstood. I mean, I'll give you one example. There was a famous book published in 1987, and it was called 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Returning in 1988. Well, Jesus didn't return in 1988, and they didn't bother with a second edition of the book. But in the late 19th and early 20th century, Christian Zionism became very popular,
mm-hmm.
because the pastors, the authors, had the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other,
mm-hmm.
and they put the two together. So, for example, at the rise of the movement, there was speculation: was is Napoleon the Antichrist? You know, the demon figure,
uh-huh.
because he was opposing Christians, he was persecuting the church in France.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when Napoleon wasn't the Antichrist, is it communism? Because again, they're persecuting the church. So there have been many failed interpretations of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question specifically, God did promise the Jews the right to live in God's land.
Mm-hmm.
He never gave them the land. He never gave them the freehold. He gave them leasehold.
Uh-huh.
Freehold is when you pay for a piece of land and it's yours,
mm-hmm.
and then you build a house on it.
Mm-hmm.
Leasehold is where you don't own the land, you rent it,
mm-hmm.
and you build a house and you pay rent to the person who owns the land.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible emphasizes, God says, the land is mine and you are aliens and strangers in my land. So where Zionism goes wrong is that it says, no, the land is ours.
Mm-hmm.
But God's word says, no, the land is mine. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Ishmael, they were all aliens and strangers because God had prepared something better for them and us, which is heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Earth is a temporary residence.
Yes.
So the idea that we can hang on to it is laughable, really, in terms of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no promise in Scripture that insists the Jews have an exclusive right to the land or a permanent right to the land.
Mm-hmm.
They were often warned, obey and you can stay,
mm-hmm.
rebel and you're out. So the history of the Jewish people is a constant exile from the land when they rebelled against God.
Mm-hmm.
When they came back, they were told to share it, to share the inheritance with
mm-hmm.
the foreigners living among you.
Mm-hmm.
So the emphasis of the Hebrew Scriptures particularly is that the land was to be shared by all people of faith.
So just to sort of back up Stephen Sizer scripturally there, Leviticus 25:25, I think it's actually 23:25, is pretty clear. Do not sell the land permanently, for the land is mine, and you are but my tenants. And this is God's law to the Jews. So, you know, the idea that it's somehow real estate, which can be peddled by the Israeli state, is actually not biblical at all. But there are, of course, all sorts of different interpretations here. So the longer interview is absolutely fascinating. It's a deep insight into not only what's going on right now with this attempt to turn this into a religious war between so-called Jews and Muslims, but also quite an insight into Stephen himself and his how he came to be playing this very important role as a ex-British vicar from a parish church in Virginia Water, to explaining to the world what is going on, what is really going on, peeling away these various evil ideas that have brought us to where we are today with this attempt at a World War III, a religious war. And just following up from last week, the look at the Stephen Knight book about the Jack the Ripper murders, that is to say, Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution, from the late 1970s, early 1980s, that book is in that interview. I thought it'd be interesting to look at the connections between Freemasonry and witchcraft.
Freemasonry uses Egyptian pagan symbols quite often, and we can see that. And one that comes to mind is the obelisk. The obelisk is a tall pillar in stone, tapered and square in section, with a pyramidion on top. And that was used among the Egyptians as a resurrection symbol. And the idea was it was actually a phallic symbol. It stood tall and erect, and it was used to procreate. And one was resurrected through one's offspring, and that was the argument. Well, the same thing applies today. And we find that where Freemasons are buried, for instance, very often it'll be an obelisk that's used as a grave marker. Sir John A. Macdonald, first Prime Minister of Canada, or George Washington, first President of the United States, their grave markers both contain obelisks, and sometimes even the obelisk will even contain the compass and square to indicate quite clearly where they're coming from.
Well, in order to join witchcraft, you have to be first screened. You have to be recommended by somebody currently in witchcraft.
Well, when I was initiated, I was blindfolded and bound by rope, and on your bare chest was thrust the point of a spear.
In witchcraft, we were initiated through a very involved ritual wherein the candidate was led blindfolded, bound by a rope, to the edge of the magic circle.
And the rope is around your neck and your lid forward. And up front, in the eastern end of the building, is a person who's a worshipful master. And you kneel down before him as if he were a god.
You are met by the high priest or high priestess with a sword to your chest.
When I went to enter the lodge, a sharp object was put to my left breast. And I was warned that should I reveal any of the secrets of Freemasonry, to know what to expect.
When you're presented before the high priest, a sword is held against your chest, and you actually take a blood oath, promising to remain faithful to the secrets of witchcraft.
Well, when you are in the room, this blindfold is taken away from you, and this is a time when they say that you're coming from darkness into light.
During the initiation ceremony, the initiate is led by the lieutenant of the high priest and is challenged at the edge of the circle by someone saying, "Who goes there?" And the answer is, "One from the world of darkness."
In Masonry, the prayers are ended with, "So mote it be."
We would always end any spell or ritual, this is where the power was released, with the word, "So mote it be."
Well, they don't tell you that in Harry Potter and the Deadly Hallows, do they? Actual Harry Potter stuff, I suppose, is was developed as a kind of reaction, it seems to me, against the Lord of the Rings, as a kind of different way of having a kind of adventure story involving magic. But the Lord of the Rings was, of course, written by J.R. Tolkien, who many people don't realise actually was one of the translators of the Jerusalem Bible, which is a Catholic Bible, an excellent, the best, I would suggest, translation, which uses Yahweh, the name of God, throughout it, rather than things like Lord or whatever. And the point is that if you go through the Lord of the Rings, you will see Freemasonry mentioned in symbols. So the white hand of Saruman is the white gloves of the Freemasons. And you don't need to be a genius to work out who the Sauron's eye is as well. I mean, you know, looking at Illuminati and that sort of thing. So, or Luciferianism. So there is a lot of symbolism in the Lord of the Rings. And it's a pity that the Harry Potter stuff doesn't really get into some of these witchcraft stroke Freemasonry things, because that would make it even more interesting. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also Guy Portney, Cotton, councillor for the Green Party here in Bristol, and of course to engineer Dave Bezanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And also follow Tony Gosling Censored on the Telegram channel. Please do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. That's the best way to get hold of us. And you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses right there. You can subscribe also to my weekly email list newsletter and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You can get my paperbacks via www.bilderberg.org, and if you're having any problems, do just email me with screenshots, because for some reason that website is becoming more and more difficult to get. But anyway, have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You've been listening to Not the BCFM Politics Show, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stoke Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. To please join us on Not the BCFM Politics Show next week. Until then, God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Together.